28th morning session of the Portland City Council. Good morning, Keelan. Could you please call the roll?
Good morning, Mayor. Hugh Daly.
Here.
Fritz.
Here.
Ryan.
Here.
Hardesty.
Here.
Wheeler.
Here. Under Portland City Code and state law, the City Council is holding this meeting electronically. All members of the Council are attending remotely by video and teleconference, and the city has made several avenues available for the public to listen to the audio broadcast of this meeting. The meeting is available to the public on the city's YouTube channel, eGovPDX, www.portlandoregon.gov/video, and channel 30. The public can also provide written testimony to council by emailing the council clerk at cctestimony@portlandoregon.gov. The council is taking these steps as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic and the need to limit in-person contact and promote physical distancing. The pandemic is an emergency that threatens the public health, safety, and welfare, which requires us to meet remotely by electronic communications. Thank you all for your patience, flexibility, and understanding as we manage through these difficult circumstances to conduct the city's business. And with that, we'll hear from legal counsel on the rules of order and decorum. Good morning.
Good morning, Mayor and council members. To participate in council meetings, you may sign up in advance with the council clerk's office for communications to briefly speak about any subject. You may also sign up for public testimony on resolutions or the first readings of ordinances. The published council agenda at portlandoregon.gov/auditor contains information about how and when you may sign up for testimony while the city council is holding electronic meetings. Your testimony should address the matter being considered at the time. When testifying, please state your name for the record. Your address is not necessary. Please disclose if you are a lobbyist. If you are representing an organization, please identify it. The presiding officer determines the length of testimony. Individuals generally have 3 minutes to testify unless otherwise stated. When your time is up, the presiding officer will ask you to conclude. Disruptive conduct such as shouting, refusing to conclude your testimony when your time is up, or interrupting others' testimony or council deliberations will not be allowed. If there are disruptions, a warning will be given that further disruption may result in the person being placed on hold or ejected from the remainder of the meeting. Please be aware that all council meetings are recorded. Thank you.
Thank you very much. First up is communications. Keelan, item 845. Jake's up first.
Request of Jake Doctor to address council regarding Physicians for Human Rights report detailing Portland Police Bureau brutality and Portland fire lack of response.
Good morning, Jake.
Good morning. Can you all hear me?
Yep, loud and clear.
Great. Thank you. Well, I planned to talk about the fact that Physicians for Human Rights and Human Rights Watch and other organizations just sent out a letter to 3,500 mayors and city councils around the nation and used Portland as an example of brutality and police aggression. I had planned to talk about why our police are documented as supporting far-right nationalists, but Internal Affairs and IPR have refused to investigate. I had planned to talk about the fact that our police leadership has failed, allowing over 50% of the force to be untrained, lied about chemical weapons to oversight groups, and continues to allow brutality with impunity. I had planned to talk about how Portland police only clear 12% of rape cases, 8% of thefts, and only 41% of murders, all well below the national averages. But then the other day, Mayor Wheeler talked about the election security plan. So I changed my plans. I apologize. But, my concerns are with the election security plans, something that is being worked on days before the election, when we have known that this is going to be an issue for months, in which it's stated that all options are on the table, including use of poisonous toxic chemicals that harm humans and animal life and are banned by the Geneva Convention, that include indemnification of other departments where the city is saying, come brutalize our people and don't worry about it, and further disenfranchisement of our voters. It seems that the plan from our city and from the governor is to have a conversation about acceptable collateral damage. Who and what are we willing to sacrifice? So like usual, in the face of failures from our police and the community's demand for change, the ask is for more money and more resources. So I hope to ask of all of you, our commissioners and the mayor, a few questions, and I hope to have some answers. how many Black and Indigenous and activists of colors being beaten by police are acceptable? How many times should we allow our city and elected officials to disenfranchise us? And this is not hypothetical, as Portland police has gassed homes while parents begged them not to. A father was assaulted while begging the police to not gas his children. How many toddlers and families being gassed in their beds are acceptable? And my final question, Mayor Wheeler, you said in a tweet that you had met with business community about public safety. Have you met with the families who have been beaten or gassed by the police? Have you met with the fathers who have been attacked by Portland police? Have you met or seen the children who have been provided gas masks by our community, not by the city, but by community members who have raised those funds for themselves? And have you met with the people, the 92% of people whose crimes have not been solved by Portland police? Have you met with the people who have had their rapes not cleared by the police when only 12%? Have you met with the 60% of Portland who have not had the murder charges cleared by Portland police? So we ask for more funds, we ask for more money for a police force who's solving crimes well below the national averages. And the response is, let's continue to give money or let's give more.
Thank you.
I know that's a lot of questions, but I thank you for your time.
Yeah, and Jake, the answer is yes. You shouldn't assume just because there's a tweet that says I'm meeting with this group or that group that it's exclusionary to all others. I have many constituents I meet with, literally thousands of people in every corner of this city. There's virtually nobody that I won't talk to as the mayor of this community. So the answer is yes. And I always appreciate your thoughtfulness. I disagree with some of the conclusions you draw, but I always appreciate your participation and your perspective and your thoughtfulness. So thank you for being here today. Next individual, please, Keelan.
846, request of Dana Lewis to address council regarding shelter-in-place villages.
Good morning, Dana.
Can you hear me?
Yep, you sound good.
Okay, great. Good morning, Mayor and Council. Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to speak. And thank you, Mayor Wheeler, for coming to C3PO the other day to actually see on site what I'm going to talk about today. So C3PO was created as response to the crisis at hand and trying to figure out how we could have shelter-in-place camps. And that came together in March very quickly. Within 2 weeks, 17 different orgs came together, led by JOIN, to figure out how to do this and supported by the city. And we are up for funding. Our funding is supposed to be through December 31st, and I'm here today to encourage you to extend our funding for that. The village model is inspired by existing models of Dignity Village and R2D2, and they have helped us work towards the success of what's happening on site. So C3PO is a really innovative incubator for change and progress that contributes to part of the solution towards affordable housing. I hope that all of you got to see the videos that I submitted by people who are in our villages right now. The gentlemen were Red and Taj, and they both spoke very clearly about the end game for them is actually housing, and that the notion that they're able to be safe in these villages right now, it contributes to their ability to thrive and be able to feel safe and look for jobs and be supported. And that is just going on daily in really innovative ways. I am the director of an organization called Gather Make Shelter. And I started 3 years ago and been working with 21 different locations and agencies across Portland and joined the coalition as soon as this started and trying to figure out how we can not only help people survive but thrive during this time. And Gather Make Shelter contributes many different parts of the project, including job skills and creative solutions to bringing community together. Some of the examples of this were as soon as the camp started on the east side, I got a call from the east side industrial business people saying, you know, that's gonna look kind of ugly. What do you think about that? And I said, well, you have the opportunity here to contribute something that could be different. So they got on board and I got them to fund the clouds in the water that we designed and put up and sponsored with the people who are in the villages. And not only was that a win-win for the people who are in the business association wanting to see something, as we were sort of wrapping up that project, somebody from the BIPOC community, Alberto, who's become a really dear friend, said to me, I just want you to know that this changes everything for us, because we don't walk into a cage of tents. We walk into the clouds and the water. And when people ask us where we live, we have the dignity of saying we live behind the clouds and the water. That also extended to the Northwest Neighborhood Association saying, hey, what did you do on the other side and what can you do on this side, looking at the Northwest location. And I talked to them about the clouds and the water on the outside being a real strong benefit for the people on the outside as well as the inside. But I also said that the people on the inside were curious to know if they could have the clouds on the water on the inside. So the Northwest Neighborhood
Association. Your time is up.
Oops. Okay.
Mayor, could we let her finish, please? I would love to hear what else she has to say, and I have a question.
You bet. Yeah, please go ahead and continue. Thanks, Dana.
Thank you, Commissioner. Okay, so I'm giving examples of the correlations between, the Gathermic Shelter and C3PO draws connections between all the communities, who are inside the villages and the communities outside, and brings people together to help form solutions. So the people in the Northwest Neighborhood Association said, yes, we will fund this. And yes, the clouds and the water can be on the inside. And even though we don't see that, we want to contribute to the health and well-being of people who are living in that village. So when we were installing those wraps on the inside, and we pay Gathermic Shelter provides stipends for everybody who participates in the project. And people on site said, these are beautiful. Like, how did this happen? And I said, well, you know, I'm pretty scrappy and I fundraise and ask. All the stuff from Gathermic Shelter is funded by citizens and businesses around the city, individuals. And I said, people in the condominiums and businesses around here have asked, have said that they wanted to contribute to your health and well-being. And the person said, I can't believe that, because I thought those people hated us. And I said, no, actually, they're really interested in supporting you. I just want to say a couple other little things about some of our projects and some of the outcomes. And we've started a gardening project that has turned into not only people being gardeners on site of all the projects, it's also turned into people getting jobs offsite as a result of the connections that we've made and helped make for people. It's not just the projects coming from Gather Make Shelter and coming from the people who are living in the villages that are igniting these ideas. It's also other people. So for example, somebody recently came to me from Dennis Uniforms, Tom Shipley, and said, I'd like to help you start a little cottage industry in printing t-shirts, because you've asked to have more t-shirts, but why don't you print your own? So they're buying us the machines to do that. Then Killian Pacific, who's a big developer in town, came to us and said, we understand you're starting a little cottage industry. Would you like a space? And they're giving us a space, which actually we're opening today in the Pearl District. And so it's connecting people inside and out, and people are trying to find ways to connect with the project to help C3PO and the village model survive, but thrive into the future. And I just want to thank you for your extended time and for hearing our case. This morning also I got in the mail, just went to the post box office, and we were just noted by Portland Monthly as the organization that does the most with the least from the Light of Fire Awards. And I just got a note from Tobias Reed, the Oregon State Treasurer, saying thank you so much for all this work. We're following you and we want you to continue, and we appreciate it.
Awesome.
So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dana. I think Commissioner Hardesty had a question as well.
Yes, I did. Thank you so much, Dana, for your testimony. What timely testimony it is. I want to also make sure that I make a point that the mayor and I worked miracles to put those camps in place. And I am so proud to see the business community stepping up in ways that I knew they would. Not just the neighborhood business associations, but also Portland Business Alliance. Without the support of businesses downtown, we would have never been able to do that. And I am just so proud of how the community has come together with very limited resources to do some fabulous work. And you just warmed my heart today, because I was just thinking how horribly cold it was out there this morning when I went on my walk. So you've warmed my heart knowing that we are helping people stabilize and get employment and get their lives on track. So you are just, thank you for what you're doing. I greatly appreciate you and all the folks who've stepped up. We don't hear it too often at City Council about all the volunteer efforts that are supporting our folks on the street, but I hear about it constantly from community members. Thank you for making time to be here today. Didn't have any questions. I just wanted to give you lots of love because this is a day where people who are doing extraordinary work should receive lots of love. So thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Hardesty. I appreciate that so much. And also, I really appreciate Matt and the people in your office who continue to come to our coalition meetings and really listen and show up at camps and hear what we have to say. And I feel your love and continued support. So thank you so much.
You're very welcome. That's why we pay them the big bucks. So everywhere. Thank you. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dana. And again, thank you for the visit the other day. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
I really appreciate it, too.
Thank you. Next individual, please.
847, request of Caitlin Day to address council regarding audit of enhanced service districts.
Good morning, Caitlin.
Hello, good morning, City Commissioners. My name is Caitlin. I'm a researcher with Western Regional Advocacy Project who's been investigating Portland's enhanced services districts for the past 3 years. As most of you know, RAP's research is what prompted the city to do an audit of ESDs, which you learned more about last Thursday. I greatly appreciate the critical questions asked by commissioners during the session, especially coming from Hardesty and UDaily. I hope that critical lens stays with the council as a whole. I wanted to highlight something that Alexandra said during that session. I really think the first thing council needs to do is closely investigate the subcontracts ESDs have with the police, the district attorney, and private security. The audit did not focus on these contracts, but they are the most concerning aspects of ESDs by RAP's perspective. So we submitted public records requests recently where we received a bevy of documents from the auditor. And in one of those documents, an interview with the head of Portland Patrol, the auditor had, he was resistant to give any information about the activities of the security officers, even saying at one point the auditor had no right to ask him these questions by virtue of them being a private company. I also want to highlight what Hardesty said during the audit presentation of how it is entirely unfair that by virtue of owning a lot of property and having a lot of money, you can have access to the police and the district attorney, of which the public does not have. I think this is especially concerning when we see groups like Portland Business Alliance, who is one of the largest lobbying bodies in Portland, are consistently having closed door meetings with these entities through things like the Downtown Security Network, which are not open to the public. So basically they have access to all this information that we don't. And to me, this is affecting the city decision-making that the public has no say in that. So this is another example of how these districts are inherently inequitable, no matter how much oversight we do. These districts are intentionally designed this way, and this isn't a broken system. So you're going to have to respond to this audit, and I hope you do so by considering all options on the table. This includes seriously considering dissolving these districts entirely instead of just jumping to reforming them. I think we are so past the point of reforming these districts, and because they are inherently inequitable by their makeup, I don't think we need to be jumping to reform, and we need to consider actually getting rid of these districts. So on a related note, I wanted to end by quickly urging council to support Hardesty's proposed amendments to cut the PPB budget by $18 million. With that said, though, as we defund the public police, it is imperative we don't turn around and start funding private policing of public spaces, such as what happens through ESDs. I honestly have a lot more to say on this topic, but I cannot cover it in this 3 minutes. But I really encourage you to consult with RAP and RAP's members, Sisters of the Road, and Right to Survive as you continue the process to address this audit. We are always ready and willing to talk, and we have a vast amount of knowledge. And we especially would love to know what your intended next steps are. That's all I have today. Thank you, commissioners.
Thank you, Caitlin.
Next up, we have 848 request.
My hand was up.
Oh, sorry, Commissioner Hardesty.
That's okay. I had a question for Caitlin. Caitlin, the Central East Side Service District is the newest one. And as you know, we took great pains to make that one a lot different than the other ones. Do you have any reflections on the newest one that is in the Central East Side Industrial District?
Yeah, so I think the main problem with it is during the Central East Side formation process, one of the main points of contention was the private security contract.
Right.
And I feel like a lot of us, as we've seen that go forward, it seemed like it wasn't actually addressing a lot of our concerns we had with security. Instead, it was just rebranding by calling them safety ambassadors. And especially if you see like on their website, they often say that they don't conduct sweeps. But one thing that they do is that they will, if a private business calls, tell people to move along. And we have heard from people who are living outside in the Central East Side that a lot of times it kind of seems like an intimidation tactic, and they're constantly being told on like public sidewalks that they need to move, even though they're not actually in front of businesses. So that really is the big concern. And we're also not seeing as much accountability from the Central East Side as we'd like to see. Like, it is good they're doing a lot of oversight. They are sharing a lot of reports that the other ESDs don't, but we're still not seeing their board being very representative of the houseless community. I know that on their safety oversight committee, they have at least one houseless person. But from what we've been told is that they haven't been able to attend the meetings as often as they'd like. So even though they're technically on the board, they're still not having a lot of input. And I just don't see it operating exactly how it was supposed to. And even when it was passed with the amendments that were made, I still was pretty critical of them. And I think that kind of goes back to just that inherent inequity that these are always going to be controlled by property owners. And just because there's some representation from the houseless community, it's not actually by and for the houseless community.
Thank you so much.
So those are some of the reflections I have.
I appreciate your reflections. I do think that because it's the newest enhanced service district that we have an opportunity to make that one a model. And so I look forward to following up with you later on your ideas, as well as other RAP members' ideas about how we could make that one a model. I think that one, because it doesn't hire police and it doesn't hire DAs, is probably the one that we can have the most impact on at the moment as we look at the ones that are coming up for renewal. I really appreciate you being here and your insight. And thank you, and thank RAP, because you're right. Without RAP pushing, the audit probably would not have happened as timely as it did. So I appreciate your work.
Yes, thank you. I think the one we're most critical of is Clean and Safe. So we're definitely going to have a lot of discussions about that going forward since they're up for renewal in 2021.
I suspect we all will. Thank you.
Yeah.
Appreciate you being here. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
848. Oh, I'm sorry, 48.
848, okay. Yep. Request of Al Ochoa to address council regarding emergency relief funds for cannabis businesses suffering loss and damages due to increased criminal activity and recent wildfires.
Good morning, Al.
Hey, Lynn, do you see him?
Yes, Al is
okay.
There we go.
Hello.
Hi, Al.
Hi, Honorable Mayor and distinguished city commissioners. My name is Al Ochoa. I'm the chair of the Cannabis Policy Oversight Team, an advisory body for the Office of Community and Civic Life. I'm also the corporate risk manager for a large multi-state operator with several licensed facilities within the city of Portland. I have been an involved and passionate advocate for several years as well. CPOT advises on policies to deliver industry, diversity, equity, accessibility, and sustainability for the city's total benefit. Although stigmatized, this industry does not exist in isolation. CPOT recognizes the symbiosis between the business owners, a more diverse, essential cannabis workforce, and the countless cannabis patients and consumers residing within the city, many of which are within BIPOC communities. The resources provided to Portlanders via the cannabis industry extend well beyond the cannabis tax revenue. In addition to being one of the few remaining industries in the city with an active workforce, this industry provides vital relief to those suffering from the myriad of mental health challenges experienced in 2020. The cannabis market has had record growth in sales since the start of the pandemic. Still, cannabis businesses have been excluded from federal emergency relief programs. Also, the lack of access to banking services, as well as expensive and limited insurance offerings stacked with the burden of targeted robberies and wildfires, adds additional hurdles. Our October 12th letter to council suggested that the impact of losses have already been dramatic and will have a lingering impact on the businesses, but also the cannabis workforce and ultimately the patients and consumers. To share a personal example, CPOT Vice Chair John Monteleone suffered a targeted and violent robbery on August 21st when two armed men stole almost $250,000 in cash and inventory. John's partner was tied up and violently beaten for 17 minutes. In fact, the police did not arrive for several minutes. The resulting losses were uninsured due to a lack of sufficient coverage. Additionally, many cannabis workers like John's partner have suffered the trauma of multiple robberies and ongoing concerns for safety. Given the brazen nature of robberies, customers may also be exposed to more risk. So CPOT wants to ensure sustainability of the cannabis tax fund as an ongoing resource to support BIPOC community impacts. In addition to diminishing unregulated market activity, the industry is supposed to be a safer access point for patients and consumers, specifically those that are still disproportionately targeted in cannabis-related police interactions. Therefore, we have these critical requests of our city's leadership today. One, support the safety and needs of Portland's cannabis patients and consumers by helping maintain legal access to these essential services. Two, protect the essential workforce of the cannabis industry from the negative consequences of under-resourced and overburdened employers. And lastly, use industry-generated resources to recover and sustain essential cannabis businesses now and in the future. As needed, CPOT will continue to educate, inform, and advise the city on policies that will ensure the legal cannabis industry is diverse, equitable, accessible, and sustainable in 2020 and beyond. Thank you.
Thank you, Al. Appreciate it. And last but not least, Keelan 849, please.
Request of Kim London to address council regarding emergency relief funds for cannabis businesses suffering loss and damages due to increased criminal activity and recent wildfires.
Good morning, Kim. Kim, are you unmuted?
I am. I thought I would be cool and just jump right in.
There you go. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, and thanks for this opportunity to speak with you today. As stated, I'm Kim London. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Cannabis Association. For those that don't know, we're a trade association representing over 250 cannabis businesses across Oregon with large representation in our home city of Portland. I'm speaking today on behalf of our members in full support of CPOT's request for emergency relief funds. Portland cannabis businesses have recently suffered from financially devastating damages and losses due largely to increased targeted criminal activity. These businesses are in danger of staying solvent, and ultimately without a viable cannabis business economy, the city's adult use cannabis tax fund will not continue to grow at its average rate of 36%, which provides much needed resources for community grants. Small businesses have been hit hard around our city this year. We know it's been a tough year for everyone, but the cannabis industry is facing some particular challenges that make our need for aid from the city level unique. We can't lose sight of the precarious position they are in because they do not qualify for the traditional structures that we've put in place to protect small businesses, like Al outlined before. Much of this comes from banking. Because of federal schedulization affects access to banking, this means that we are a growing industry that is built off of family loans and personal credit cards. The lack of banking does not just mean a high level of cash on hand, which is devastating for a retailer who is robbed. It also means that most of these small businesses lack access to financing to help them recover from these losses and loans to help them repair and rebuild. The increase in robberies has led to high costs for extra security, property damage, and lost revenues when stores are forced to close or for repairs or to rehire staff. Our members have reported store-wide staff walkouts after armed robberies. On the whole, our industry is suffering. Employees are scared and business owners are worried about how to get through the next month after unprecedented revenue loss. As I was writing this, I got a text message from one of our members who had just received her third armed robbery in one of her stores. These robberies are not one-off situations. This is an epidemic that is particular to our city's dispensaries with potentially disastrous effects for the industry. Now, on top of that, the wildfires have threatened the supply chain for us throughout the state. We are just starting to get reports in Portland of unusable oil due to smoke damage from this year's harvest. Given how widespread the smoke coverage was in our state, this is deeply concerning. On the October 12th letter, CPOT submitted a letter to the council offices outlining three critical requests that will help support the continued growth of the city's cannabis industry and long-term sustainability. The funds CPOT requested for the aid are those above the estimated 4% growth forecast. When COVID first hit, our dispensaries were allowed to stay open, thanks in part to the efforts of this council. And if not for that, the industry would have been decimated. But because of that foresight, our industry has far exceeded the estimated growth. Now, if we want that growth to be sustainable, we must protect these small businesses in their current moment of crisis. Thank you.
Thank you. And Commissioner Udaly has her hand raised.
Thank you, Mayor. Well, I just want to thank Al and Kim for giving testimony today. I've already responded to the CPOT letter, and I know that I imagine you've read it. I share your concerns. I want to share with my colleagues that robberies of dispensaries have tripled in the last several months. And as you heard, some of them are happening during business hours, and they're armed robberies, which you know, whether someone's injured or not is extremely traumatic to experience. Although cannabis has been legalized in Oregon, obviously it's not legal under federal law. And so the industry faces a lot of unique challenges and I think ongoing discrimination and stigma, despite the fact that it's legal in Oregon. So I am committed to helping find resources that these businesses can qualify for since we can't allocate federal relief dollars. You've read the letter. I don't want to reiterate everything I said in the letter here, but just thank you for being here. I'm aware, I'm very concerned, and my staff and civic life are working on this issue to try to support the industry through these really challenging times.
Thank you, Commissioner Udaly. Commissioner Ryan, did you have a comment? Yes, no, maybe.
Kim and, Al, I too want to join Commissioner Udaly in my appreciation for your comments. I think a lot of people don't understand what you're facing, your obstacles with the fire, the supply chains are affected, the FDIC, the banking, financial infrastructure challenges, and then to top it all off, you have an increase in criminal activity. So the city of Portland needs to stand with you. Your revenues are actually very helpful as well to the public good, And also there's a mental health crisis going on and a lot of people depend on that for medicine. So anyway, thank you for educating all of us today.
Yeah, I'll jump in here on the bandwagon as well. Thank you, Kim and Al, for coming today and sharing your concerns. Your industry provides a bright spot in the future of our economy. We have a potential opportunity here. We were one of the first states in, but we're at risk of squandering that leadership position. My office is really happy to continue to work with your industry on a number of opportunities, including potentially expanding the opportunity for people to use products in a social setting. Additionally, the Safe Banking Act is something that I've supported for many years, and we need to acknowledge that your industry is a legal industry, it is a regulated industry, it is a taxed industry, and therefore it should be allowed the same privileges and standards as any other legal, taxed, and regulated industry. And so I look forward to continuing to work with you and other advocates and leaders in the industry. And I'm hopeful that as the tides turn here politically, we'll have more opportunities, particularly at the federal level, to make the changes we need to help our local community thrive. And at the local level, I understand absolutely the imperative of providing the same kind of support mechanisms for your operations that other businesses are entitled to. Obviously, our federal dollars come with restrictions, but I believe there is always more we can do here at the local level to support our entrepreneurs and our small business owners and operators. And I thank you for your continued leadership. So thanks for coming in today. We appreciate hearing from you. Keelan, that completes our communications for this morning. Have any items been pulled off of the consent agenda?
No, we've had no requests.
Please call the roll.
You, Daly.
Aye.
Fritz.
Aye.
Ryan.
Aye.
Hardesty.
Aye.
Wheeler.
Aye. The consent agenda is adopted, and I want to thank Commissioner Hugh Daly for the grant that we just approved from the Oregon Department of Transportation for the Park Rose Neighborhood Action Plan. I think that's awesome, and I really want to acknowledge the work of your team as well as the PBOT crew for that as well.
Thank you, Mayor.
Next up is time certain. According to my clock, we're good to start with item number 850.
Initiate foreclosure action on three properties for the collection of delinquent city liens placed against the properties.
Colleagues, this ordinance begins the foreclosure proceedings on four properties with delinquent city liens that are eligible for foreclosure under City Code 5.30. The liens were placed against the properties by the Bureau of Development Services for code enforcement, code violations, nuisance abatement, or chronic offender violations and are delinquent on their lien payments. These properties have been identified as causing significant problems for neighbors and are subject of multiple and frequent police calls and numerous enforcement activities. These properties come before council as part of a coordinated effort by the Mayor's Office, the Bureau of Development Services, and the Office of Management and Finance, the Bureau of Revenue and Financial Services, the Revenue Division, to actively pursue remedies, including foreclosure for vacant and distressed properties. It should be noted that these foreclosures are not a result of the COVID-19 pandemic, but rather resulting from years of delinquencies and violations. Before we bring up Marco Maciel to present, colleagues, I have been provided a proposed substitute ordinance. This was in the Tuesday memo. I'd like to move a substitute ordinance.
Second.
We have a motion from myself, a second from Commissioner Hardesty. Keelan, please call the roll on the substitute.
Hugh Daly.
Aye.
Fritz.
Aye.
Ryan.
Aye.
Hardesty.
Aye.
Wheeler.
All right, the substitute's on the table. Good morning, Marco.
Good morning, Mayor. How are you? My name is Marco Maciel, foreclosure manager in the Bureau of Revenue and Financial Services, Revenue Division. With me as part of the group is Mike Fell, supervising planner with the Bureau.
Marco, I'm having troubles hearing you. Colleagues, are you having the same problems? Can you do us a favor, Marco? Could you turn off your video? That will help with the bandwidth a bit. And can you move the microphone closer to you so we can hear you just a little bit better?
Okay. Thank you. Hear me better?
Yeah, much better. Thank you. That's good. Great.
And with me is Mike B. Feld, Supervising Planner with the Bureau of Development Services, Bridget O'Callaghan, City Treasurer, and Dan Simon, Deputy City Attorney. Next, please.
Marco, sorry, you're still cutting out. Is there some way somebody else could read your part of the presentation?
Unfortunately, I don't think so. But let me try again.
Okay.
This is the seventh foreclosure list we have brought to council. The properties included on the foreclosure list today are vacant and distressed properties provided to Revenue Division by the Bureau of Development Services. Is that better?
Yes.
Development Services, which is the Bureau responsible for the enforcement of housing maintenance violations, identified these properties as priority properties for foreclosure and submit them to the Revenue Division for vetting and processing for council to vote on whether to foreclose on the properties within the proposed ordinance. The objectives of the process are to resolve the nuisance problems of vacant and distressed properties that we have throughout the city, minimize the adverse effect caused by these properties in the community, and bring these properties to a productive use. This is a common effort by the Bureau of Development Services, the Revenue Division of the Bureau of Revenue and Financial Services, the City Treasurer, and the City Attorney's Office. Is that issue okay? Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, we can hear you just fine.
The City of Portland and the community at large have the reasonable expectation that property owners are responsible for the maintenance of their properties. The city, through its Property Compliance Division in the Bureau of Development Services, adopted a property maintenance minimum standard. To achieve compliance when a property doesn't meet the minimum standard, BDS's approach includes appeals, a host of waivers that property owners may qualify for to avoid liens, and the opportunity to connect property owners with available repair assistance programs for their situation. Only after these opportunities or incentives to correct the violations are exhausted, monthly code enforcement fees are adopted. The characteristics of vacant and distressed properties cannot be easily explained. Every situation is different, but they have these similarities. Little to no action is taken by property owners to rehabilitate their properties. The city's fees increase, and there is infrequent or no communication by the property owner with the city, even after the city tries multiple approaches and incentives over a long period of time. Additionally, it is difficult to explain how it would be in a property owner's best interest to own an investment or a property that are not producing cash flow. Next slide, please. Since 2016, slide number five, please. Thank you. Since 2016, the efforts of the foreclosure process have resulted in 88 properties proposed for foreclosure by the Bureau of Development Services, of which 25 have been brought to council for vote, 68 have been paid in full, and 3 have made payment arrangements. The amount recovered exceeds $2,873,000, and the process has motivated many property owners to find a resolution to their properties. The recovery rate is over 81%. I want to emphasize here that most of what we achieve is in lieu of foreclosure. We have brought so far $23 million, and So far, we have only dealt with 25 properties to foreclose that we brought to council, and out of those, a lot of them resolved the problems without having to be foreclosed. Just to emphasize that the effort of the city is not to take anybody's properties, but to try to help them to bring the properties into compliance with city code. Next, please. Today, the Revenue Division is submitting to Council a list with three vacant and distressed properties with a recommendation to be foreclosed. Each of the properties is vacant and distressed and has been consuming the limited resources that the city has to continue working towards improving livability, health, and safety in our communities. Again, I would like to remember that the reason why we have a substitute ordinance is that as of yesterday, one of the property owners came to the city and presented a plan and is working on it, and so it was removed from the list. The next slide, please. Instead of four, should be three properties. And this property is located at 3633 Southeast Schiller Street. There are four liens against this property, 6 years of delinquency, and between April 11th of 2011 and November 18th of 2019, police intervened 57 times directly to the property or its vicinity. The amount owed to the city is over $40,000. This property belongs to Mr. Russell J. Milroy. Next one, please. This property was partially consumed by fire 6 years ago, and the property owner has been unable to find a solution to make the property habitable again. Trash and debris have accumulated on the exterior areas of the property. The property has been a source of complaint by neighbors to the Revenue Division, to the Bureau of Development Services, and the Police Department. The next one, please. The second property is located at 5080 Southeast Cooper Street. There are three liens against this property, 19 years of delinquency, and between November of 2011 and November of 2019, police intervened 23 times directly to the property or its vicinity. The amount delinquent owed to the city is in excess of $92,000. This property belongs to Mr. Jeffrey Craig. He has owned this property since May of 1986. Next one, please. Next slide. According to reports provided by the Development Services Inspectors, violations detected in September of 2015 were never corrected by May of 2019 when the inspector returned to the property. Next slide, please. The last property is located at 9101 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard. There are four liens against this property. The amount delinquent owed to the city is in excess of $68,000. And the owner of record is Mr. Norman E. 2 years of delinquency between February 2016 and August of 2018, police intervened 10 times directly to the property or its vicinity. Next, please. 12 inspections have been performed by the city to this property. 19 complaints received by the Bureau of Development Services related to the condition of the property. This property owner at one point owned 11 properties within the city limits, and every single one of his properties had serious housing violations. And some of you members of the council have or are familiarized with the name of the property owner. The next one, please. The city offered many opportunities to property owners to correct the violations and solve the delinquencies of their, on their properties. As an example, when property owners are willing to resolve the violations, they can contact the Bureau of Development Services and request a review of their cases. Once the review is complete, the amount owed is decreased, then the Revenue Division will provide a payment plan that allow the property owners to repay the amount owed in up to 6 month installments. Another example is the Bureau of Development Services Amnesty Program, where if the property is free of code violations, the property owner can enroll and pay a portion of the amount owed and or pay the remainder in monthly installments. As discussed, the city has made many attempts to assist these property owners to rehabilitate their properties, but our efforts have gone unanswered. Therefore, the Revenue Division of the Bureau of Revenue and Financial Services recommends that council approve these properties to foreclose. Next, please. The next step in the city's foreclosure process are for the council to vote on whether to foreclose on the properties within this proposed ordinance. If the ordinance is approved, the Revenue Division will transfer the responsibility to the city treasurer to conduct the foreclosure sale. The property owner can pay the amounts owed up to the sale date. After the sale is conducted, the current owner still has 1 year redemption period. And this concludes our presentation, and we are happy to answer any question that you may have.
Mayor, if I may.
Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you. Marco, I just want to say I'm really grateful for the very detailed work that you do prior to attempting to foreclose on a property. Reading through your information, it is clear that we're not just running out trying to grab up as much property as we can as a city. And so I just want to compliment you and your team. Because by the time it gets to the city council, clearly you've done everything within your power to get that correct, those properties back up to an appropriate standard. So my compliments to you and your team. I remember the last time we had this, we had foreclosures on the agenda. There was a lot of outrage around it, but I just want to compliment you. Clearly, this is a last resort when it gets in front of the city council. So thank you for your good work.
Thank you very much, Commissioner.
Thank you, Commissioner Hardesty. Commissioner Daly.
Thank you, Mayor. I also appreciate the process and the information you've shared with us. I think it really deeply pains me to think of anyone losing their property. And I know that we've given these owners many options. I do wonder if any of these property owners are BIPOC community members. And I realize this may be beyond our scope. Do we have any idea if they have the resources to make the improvements? I mean, there's multiple reasons why a property falls into disrepair, and it's not always a lack of financial resources. So I'm just curious if we know much.
We go out of our way.
Yeah.
To find sometimes they need, there are fights, there are divorces, there are things like, if they are not a property owner that invested in the property, which is what the majority of they are. And so one of the difficulties lately is that nowadays we don't find any lawyer providing pro bono services. We used to have the college up on the hill in the Southwest that provide a group of people to help those who have the need and did not have the condition to pay for. But nowadays it's almost impossible to find. And many of them is, they come to a place of the, start to defer the maintenance of the property. And so as time goes by and the roof starts to leak and things like start to happen, the decay starts, the only solution is to leave the house and the house stays behind, and we are the ones who have to come forward because the neighborhood starts to be affected by, and they keep calling us and requesting us to intervene, and that's what we are here for, but not to, we really avoid bringing a property foreclosure, and sometimes cause some discomfort because we don't have the apparatus, the need, or the intent, or desire to foreclose on a wholesale basis. I think the objective that we have is to assist those who really are in need and want to make an effort to help themselves.
Are any of the three properties owner-occupied currently?
No, none of them. They are all vacant and distressed.
Yeah. I mean, I understand they can be a real hazard to neighbors. And yeah, okay, thank you.
It's a very hard situation to all of us. I don't think any one of us have any pleasure in taking anybody's life construction of what they took a life to build. And but get to a point when that a lack of responsibility or ability affect the whole neighborhood.
Well, and it's the ability part that I'm concerned with. I have a neighbor down the street, a retired woman who experiences mental illness and hoarded to the point where she had to move out of her house and became homeless. And that house, I believe, was foreclosed on and sold and had to be torn down because of the level of neglect and damage to the home. It's just really heartbreaking to me that sometimes we just can't intervene sooner and avert outcomes like this, but it does give me some comfort to know that they're not occupied.
And many of them, we are able to contact them, and they are reasonable in trying to be assisted. And many of them we have intervened successfully. And we can find, like I said, there are institutions that are able to assist. Some of them are financed by Portland Housing Bureau. And that helps a lot. Many, many of them are helped.
Maybe you should give us a report on the ones that, on the success stories to make us feel a little bit better.
I would be able, I need to go back many years because this started probably in, I don't know, 2001. But okay. I'll be more than happy to do that.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Thank you, Commissioner Udaly. Commissioner Fritz.
Thank you. And thank you, Marco, for all the work over the years. It is a very challenging problem. I think when we did this issue with Mayor Hales, I learned from you that once the council votes on the foreclosure, that's a very high percentage of property owners then start taking more interest and actually get the properties back into shape. Is that correct?
That's correct. Many of them.
I think we don't actually end up foreclosing on many of them because the council's action will be enough to get the property owner's attention. Thank you.
Uh-huh. Thank you, Commissioner Fritz. Commissioner Udaly, do you have another question? No, very good. Keelan, is there any public testimony on this item?
No one signed up for this item.
Very good. This is the first reading of a non-emergency ordinance. It goes to second reading. Thank you, Marco, for your presentation. We appreciate
it. Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Council.
You bet. Next up is 851, please, a proclamation.
Proclaim October 28th, 2020 to be Shrill Day.
Colleagues, I'm pleased to introduce this next item, the proclamation declaring today, Wednesday, October 28th, 2020, Shrill Day. Here in Portland. The Hulu comedy Shrill began filming its third season this month, right down in the South Park blocks at Portland State. This show continues the story of Annie East and her life here in Portland and stars Adie Bryant, who you know also from her work on Saturday Night Live. It's a great achievement to begin work on a third season, and it'll be great to see the new depictions of Portland on the screen. At a time when the functions of daily business activity continue to be challenging, it's great to see film production taking place safely here in Portland, utilizing local vendors, caterers, equipment houses, and crews, all based here in town. Updated health and safety protocols on set have given the production a path forward, and they're creating practices that will become a template for how film production can safely continue working in the COVID-19 era. Today, we have Brian Lord. He's the program manager of the Portland Film Office at Prosper Portland to say a few words ahead of this proclamation, as well as Lindy West, who's the executive producer and co-creator of Shrill. Brian, go ahead when you're ready.
Thank you, Mayor Wheeler, and good morning, members of City Council. I am Brian Lord, the program manager for the Portland Film Office at Prosper Portland. I'm here to offer some quick observations from the view of the Portland Film Office ahead of today's proclamation. Shrill began its third season of production here in town earlier this month and has had two seasons with more than 14 episodes already. As Mayor Wheeler mentioned, Shrill tells the story of Annie Easton and her life in Portland. It stars Adie Bryant, Lolly Adefope, Luca Jones, and John Cameron Mitchell. Shrill leads the ranks of multi-season shows produced here in Portland like Grimm, Trinkets, Portlandia, and others. The cast and crew is largely local, with 82% of the production made up of residents of the Portland metro area. There's an inherent care for how Portland looks on screen, and there's an obvious stewardship when they are filming in our neighborhoods. The ongoing partnership with Brownstone Productions, Warner Brothers Television, and Hulu has likewise created a new stewardship for our city as well, which I'll highlight in a moment. Then there is the economic impact to the local economy. In season one of production, they spent $10.8 million in Oregon on labor and local goods and services, directly supporting 247 jobs. The second season of Shrill had nearly $6 million in Portland payroll and spent more than $350,000 on hotels and hospitality in just a three-month period. In the COVID-19 era, this activity is providing critical financial resources and opportunities for many small businesses within the film production supply chain here in town. For some perspective, each season of production has generated economic activity of a comparable scale to the Small Business Relief Fund from the CARES Act work we're doing at Prosper Portland. And most importantly, Shrill is a part of film production's safe return to work in Portland. Updated health and safety protocols have been put into place, and they are helping create a template for future projects to safely complete their production. And finally, there's the cultural impact Shrill has had on our city and that our city has had on Shrill. Shrill was originally set in Seattle, but the importance of the positive experiences and relationships built with Broadway Video on Portlandia and Documentary Now helped Shrill to be produced here with a similar local core team to those other shows. As a member of the film economy here, the Oregon Media Pathways program created an opportunity for the production to add two paid interns on set during season two to shadow the crew and learn trades focused on film production. The Pathways program has a specific focus on equity, and the two women who were part of the program continue to work in the local industry. I want to say thank you to the city bureaus, especially Peabot Parks, for their partnership with the Portland Film Office, getting the production working on location within the city and at a rapid pace. Portland is a great city, and I want to thank you, City Council, for your ongoing and active support of film production here in town. And finally, speaking of support for filming in Portland, I do want to note that during season one of Shrill, Commissioner Nick Fish and I visited the production team on set along with Tim Williams of Oregon Film. The commissioner was very enthusiastic that day and very appreciative of the production being here. He was also there with his family at the Hollywood Theater on the opening night screening for season one. I have very fond memories of that time. I would now like to introduce Lindy West, executive producer and co-creator of Shrill, to say a few words.
Hi, hello, is it me?
Hi, it's you, Lindy.
Hi, thank you so much. This is such an honor. It's so, honestly, like, very moving to me to get to be here and address all of you. I'm a Pacific Northwest native. I'm from Seattle. My parents are from Seattle. We all went to the same high school. I've spent many, many wonderful months in Portland shooting Shrill. And of course, before that, I've spent tons of time in Portland. It feels like home to me. And when, you know, this whole project started many years ago in, let's see, 2015, the book, or 2015, I wrote the book, 2016, the book came out. And it's just a little memoir about my little life. And somehow it ended up here, which is very confusing. But when it came to make the time to make the show, I really insisted that I wanted to shoot it in the Northwest. I didn't want to shoot it in LA and pretend it was Portland and have some drone shots of the city. You know, I wanted to shoot it in my home. And because of the incredible local crew that had worked on Portlandia and Doc Now, we got to do that. And I think you can really feel, because it's a local crew, so much of the cast is local, you can just really feel the love for Portland and the love for the whole region. And we try to really make Portland a character in the show and present it in a really authentic, loving way. And because I'm a Pacific Northwest native, it's personal to me to be able to provide jobs for people in this region and to be able to make something that is very truly of this place. And we're starting shooting season three a little later this year than we normally do because of COVID. And gotta say, I'm kind of excited about all the rain that's gonna be in this season. You know, it's been a little bit not felt quite right to present a purely sunny Pacific Northwest for two seasons. So I'm also, because of COVID, I can't be there. So I'm not the one that has to sit outside in the tent and get rained on. So I guess maybe easy for me to say. But I just also wanted to say that we're just so grateful to the city of Portland. And you know, the cast who has come from out of town absolutely feels like it's a second home already, just after two seasons. And I kind of feel like this is backwards and that Shrill the show should be declaring today Portland Day, because we owe you so much. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lindy, so much. And congratulations on your success. And thank you, Brian, as well, for the great work that you do on behalf of the film office. So with that, I will read the proclamation. This is a proclamation on behalf of the entire City Council and by extension the city for your amazing work. Whereas Shrill is beginning its third season of production in Portland, and whereas Shrill has been an innovator in storytelling both on screen as well as behind the camera, and whereas the film website Rotten Tomatoes estimated that, quote, sharp social commentary and a star-making performance from A.D. Bryant creates a show that proves self-acceptance isn't one size fits all, unquote. And whereas Shrill joins an array of television shows that have filmed in Portland across several seasons, including The Librarians, Portlandia, Grimm, Trinkets, and The Birch. And whereas Shrill marks the continued collaboration between the City of Portland and a production team led by A.D. Bryant, Alexander Rushfield, Lindy West, Brownstone Productions, Warner Brothers, Television Hulu, and a Broadway Video. And whereas it has hired over 750 crew members over its 3 years and has had an economic impact of over $50 million as part of the nearly $500 million of direct in-state spending by the film and media industry. And whereas Shrill is as culturally significant as it is economically significant to Portland, contributing to our renown as a deeply creative culture. And whereas Shrill has had a significant impact behind the camera as it does in front of the camera, promoting the work of a diverse local cast and crew, as well as the uniqueness of the city of Portland to an international audience. And whereas, Portland City Council has previously acknowledged and affirmed support for the TV and film industry and the important role it plays in helping to make Portland a vibrant, prosperous, and livable community within City Council Resolution 37391. And now, therefore, I, Ted Wheeler, Mayor of the City of Portland, Oregon, the City of Roses, do hereby proclaim October 28th, 2020, to be Shrill Day in Portland and encourage all residents to observe this day. Thank you, and I see Commissioner Fritz would like to have a comment. Commissioner Fritz.
I just wanted to thank you, Lindy, for your leadership. My daughter and I are just really blessed by the show, and I thank you very much for putting it on. I'm jealous of my friend and colleague, Commissioner Fish, getting to visit. Maybe you'll let me come after COVID is done. Anyway, thank you so much, both of you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Udaly.
Well, I wasn't going to make comment today, but I'm too excited to see Lindy West at our council session today. No offense, Brian, but Lindy, I owned a bookstore for 22 years before I joined City Council. And just want to say that I've been a big fan of your writing for a long time, and it's such a treat to have Shrill filmed in the city and to get to see you today. And hopefully you will be able to come back to Portland sometime soon, and maybe we can all see each other in person eventually. So thanks for being here today, and thanks for Shrill.
That's awesome. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you very much, all of you, and thank you and congratulations again to you, Lindy, and thank you, Brian, for your hard work on behalf of the city. We appreciate it. Next up is item 852.
Accept the quarterly technology oversight committee report from the chief administrative officer.
The Technology Oversight Committee is a citizen advisory committee that provides oversight for significant City of Portland technology projects. Committee members are technology professionals who help to ensure projects are completed within the determined scope, on time, and on budget, providing increased transparency and accountability. The committee reports to City Council on a quarterly basis on the projects that it's currently overseeing. I'll now turn it over to our presenters, who include three Technology Oversight Committee members, Wilfred Pinfold, Diana Garcia, and Jimmy Goddard. Welcome, and thank you for your service.
Good morning, Mayor Wheeler and City Council. For the record, I'm Jeff Baer. I'm the Director of the Bureau of Technology Services, and we have a slight change up in our presentation this morning. We just have our representative, Diana Garcia. Will Pinfold was unable to make it this morning. And as you know, Diana represents Commissioner Fritz's office. And so, Keelan, can I share my screen?
Yes, Jeff, go ahead.
Okay, thank you.
And good morning, Jeff. I didn't get a chance to say hello. How are you today?
Good, thank you, Mayor.
Good.
Let's see if I can share this. Can you see that okay?
Yep, looks good.
All right, thank you. And again, just wanted to get you up to speed. Due to the pandemic, we've not been in front of City Council for some period of time. And this is a roll-up report representing the months of January through September. And we will begin resuming our regular quarterly reports to Council beginning in January. So Diana and I are here to provide some updates that may not have been covered during this reporting period. And we can also provide an update from our most recent TOC meeting, which took place this past Monday evening, and share the latest assessment. Go to slide 2 here. Slide 2, you'll see a positive assessment of the Portland online permitting system that went live in February. We were extremely fortunate to have launched that back in February prior to the pandemic. And we had to, as many of you know, we had to quickly pivot our work to a remote work environment and really provide a remote access for the Amanda system through our virtual private network. And there remains more work to continue adding new features and functionality to our permitting system. And I'll pause here and turn it over to Diana to provide some additional comments on the POPS program.
Thanks, Jeff. Good morning, Council. It's good to see you. It's been a while. We and the TOC just wanted to express a few things. One, the POPS team has done such a great job with this project. It was not an easy effort. And they had many hurdles that we counseled them through, and they took our insights and leveraged them as they could, which was fantastic. It was a really great partnership between the TOC and the POPS team. The thing we want to make sure is super clear is that they really put in the foundation for the new system. And going forward, there's so much more left to do that will just continue to make the system even better over time. The other thing that we wanted to make sure we conveyed was the system is the backbone, but it is not the end-all be-all of the solution that needs to happen for Bureau of Development Services. And we know Rebecca is doing a great job also of tackling the process issues that or process potential changes that might need to happen for BDS over the course of kind of learnings as they've deployed the system, as well as interfacing with the developers themselves. So we just want to say she's doing a great job at that, and we just ask that the council continue to support her in that work, as that will actually make the backbone and the foundation you've already laid that much more important, and will continue to provide value to the city for many years to come as you kind of enhance and make this system really something that the entire city of Portland can be proud of, and their development partners are really excited to engage with.
Thank you, Diana. I'll go to slide 3 here. And the other project that was under TOC oversight is the Bureau of Revenue and Financial Services, what's called the Integrated Tax System, or ITS. And the upside is that you can see most of the categories are in green status, and the system was actually launched on September 14. And a second part of the project, which is called the network segmentation for the federal tax information feed, is slated to be completed by the end of December. And I'll pause there, and Diana, if you have any other comments on the ITS project.
No, I think this project, as you can see, was a pretty smooth one. The project team has done an amazing job with this one as well. This in particular, though, even we had a conversation yesterday or Monday that even the hiccups they brought to our attention, they had already resolved by the time they talked to us about them. And so it was really just a pleasure on this one to see it go as smoothly as it did. I think that really speaks to the partnership between the vendor and the city, as well as the leadership team within the city that has really made this successful. So kudos to them, and really excited again to see what this can open up for opportunities for the city going forward.
Thank you, Diana. I also wanted just to recognize, I think I saw Jimmy Goddard, who is another one of our TOC members in the audience, and he represents Commissioner Udaly. And so just wanted to recognize Jimmy as being in attendance here as well. So just overall, this concludes our report, and we're glad to answer any questions.
And Commissioner Hardesty has her hand raised. Commissioner Hardesty, do you have a comment here?
I do. Thank you, Mayor. And thank you, Jeff and Diana. I just want to say that I love you guys. You guys put so much energy into helping us with our technology. And I just always appreciate the thoroughness of your work, the fact that you have expertise that we desperately rely on. So just thank you. I wish you had been here last week when we were talking about permitting at BDS, and you would have heard some of the comments from community members who are still frustrated with our system. But I do think the better we are at putting the right technology in place, the easier it will be for the public to use it, and the more the public will have a reliance on it as well. Hi, Jimmy. I didn't mean to leave you out as well. Welcome. Thanks for being here. I just think you guys are awesome. And I ask the mayor all the time, how come the technology committee isn't looking at this, right? When are we gonna get them to look at this? Not that we don't keep you busy enough, and we all know you have day jobs. So thank you so much for the work that you do. And you are one of our shining stars when it comes to committees that do what they're supposed to do and provide the information and always in a timely manner. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Fritz.
Wanted to thank Diana Garcia for having been my representative. I've been very happy with the work that you've done. And to ask Jeff Baer, does Commissioner-elect Rubio get to keep Diana if she's willing to serve, or does she have to? She does. I'm nodding there. So I'm sure you'll be having that conversation, but I will let her know how very kind and helpful that you have been. And just thanks for all the work you've done.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Ryan.
Yes, good morning. Good to see everyone. Special hello to my friend Jimmy. I want to say that I really appreciate you calling out Rebecca and BDS in a kind way. They've really had to adjust rapidly to COVID to be there for their customers. And their customers are going to tell them if they're not. So that the heat's always on with that bureau. And I just really appreciate you being patient and thorough. And thank you for partnering with them. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Commissioner Ryan. And I want to add my voice of praise, and I really want to thank Wilfred Pinfold for being my representative, but collectively, you guys just do such fabulous work. And the truth is you understand these systems and these technologies at a level that none of us do. So we're extremely grateful to have this oversight, and I appreciate the methodology you use that makes it easy for us to understand where we're being successful with our enterprise systems, where we need to really focus our attention, and the relationships you encourage us to foster and strengthen, and the ideas that you encourage us to support through our budget process is extremely helpful. It's exactly the kind of direction that we need. And I wanna thank you all, not just for doing the work, but frankly, the passion and the commitment that you bring to it. It's nearly contagious. So thank you for that. And colleagues, this is a report. So unless anybody has any other questions at this particular junction, I'll entertain a motion.
So moved, Mayor.
Can I get a second, please?
Second.
We have a motion from Commissioner Hardesty, a second from Commissioner Ryan. Any further discussion on the report? Commissioner Ryan, I see you have your hand raised, but I think that's a mistake, right?
It's a mistake.
No worries. Keelan, go ahead and call the roll.
New Daly.
Aye.
Fritz.
Again, thank you. Aye.
Ryan.
Aye.
Hardesty.
Aye.
Wheeler.
Aye. The report's accepted, and we appreciate the work, and we look forward to seeing the next one. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Let's see. That's 8:52. That brings us to our regular agenda. Item number, is it 853?
Yeah.
Hang on, gotta turn my page. That's a consent agenda, is 853. So I assume you mean 858. No worries. Item number 858.
Proclaim October 2020 to be Domestic Violence Awareness Month.
Good morning again, colleagues. I'm humbled to bring forward this proclamation with Commissioner Hardesty in recognition of National Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Domestic violence is an extremely pervasive issue that has devastating impacts on our community. The intense discomfort we feel as we consider this issue and its real-life consequences highlights the importance of taking the time to honor victims and survivors, and serves as a reminder of why the City of Portland's role in a collaborative effort in our community around this issue is so critically important. 1 in 4 women and 1 in 7 men have suffered domestic violence by an intimate partner. And it's estimated that domestic violence makes up about 15% of all violent crimes. Let's take a moment to let those numbers sink in. This work requires a high level of collaboration with service providers and local agencies. I'd now like to turn this over to Commissioner Hardesty, who is the city's representative on the Gateway Center Advisory Council and liaison to the partnership we have with Multnomah County on these issues. And after her comments, Commissioner Hardesty will also read the proclamation on behalf of the council. Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank you for the partnership in presenting this resolution today. I want to say that COVID has exacerbated domestic violence. We have seen a significant increase of calls to the 911 call center on domestic violence. The uptick in gun violence also can be partially laid at the feet of domestic violence. What we know is that in economic uncertain times, domestic violence goes up. I've had the privilege, this year will be year four, of being part of a people of color-led domestic violence program that seeks to educate and inform people who have experienced domestic violence, as well as educating practitioners who are working with victims of domestic violence to ensure that they have their needs met. One of my honors serving on the city council has been to serve on the Gateway board, the Gateway Domestic Violence Center board. And what I know is the excellent work they do 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, trying to help people be safe and have a safety plan when they are trying to escape a domestic violence situation. All the data tells us that when people are leaving, it is the most dangerous time in a relationship that is experiencing domestic violence. And that's the critical time where community resources must reach out to support community members. And so on behalf of the city council, I will read the proclamation that we've developed for this day. Whereas domestic violence is a crime that touches the lives of Portlanders of all ages, leaving a devastating impact on women, men, and children of every background and circumstance. And whereas domestic violence accounts for a significant number of assaults committed in the city of Portland, and nearly one third of Oregon women reported experiencing domestic violence, stalking, sexual, or physical assault. Nearly one third, let that sink in. Whereas Portland has demonstrated a longstanding commitment to addressing this problem in partnership with Multnomah County, the District Attorney's Office, and community providers, and whereas 11 years ago, the City of Portland, in cooperation with Multnomah County, the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, and the Multnomah County Circuit Court and community partners opened the area's first one-stop center for domestic violence victims, the Gateway Center for Domestic Violence Services. Whereas children who are exposed to domestic violence experience higher levels of adult depression and trauma symptoms and are much more likely than children not exposed to violence to use and or tolerate violence in their adult relationships. And whereas, despite this commitment, far too many women, men, families, and children in our communities are affected by domestic violence. And whereas the City of Portland recognizes and thanks all of the organizations and groups that are committed to addressing, prevent, and heal from domestic violence, often work directly with survivors to ensure they have access to employment opportunities, housing, legal resources, and other services. Now, therefore, Ted Wheeler, Mayor of the City of Portland, Oregon, the City of Roses, do hereby proclaim October 2020 to be Domestic Violence Awareness Month in Portland and encourage all residents to observe this month by gaining awareness of this issue and supporting organizations that work to address, prevent, help those affected by domestic violence. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Hardesty. And I don't know if other commissioners have any comments. Commissioner Ryan, I see your hand is raised.
Well, I had a raise from the last time, but I'm glad it was up. I just want to thank the council for taking this moment in time to acknowledge. And as Commissioner Hardesty stated, it's really obvious that domestic violence is going up. And I think it's also because of isolation. And I worry about the kids, because we know that child abuse rate incidents, reported incidents, have gone down, which just means that the teachers and the counselors don't have access to their intuition to see that. And I always think of domestic violence and how it affects children. Like many, I was one of those kids that experienced it. And so anyway, let's just know that there's a lot going on in this isolated time that that we have to be aware of and continue to do all we can to mitigate. Thanks.
Thank you, Commissioner Ryan, appreciate it. Very good. Next, oh, by the way, I before we move off of this, I also just want to acknowledge former, never mind. I want to acknowledge the numbers that Commissioner Hardesty mentioned that are called out both in this and the previous talking points that really deserve to be underscored, that a third of women in the state of Oregon indicate that they have experienced firsthand domestic violence, stalking, sexual or physical assault. And that is a statistic that we have to own and have to understand and have to continue to respond to. So thank you for this. It's not the most uplifting subject, but it's truly an important one. Commissioner Hardesty, thank you for continuing to provide leadership at the Gateway Center. That's an important institution. Here, I also want to acknowledge former Commissioner Dan Saltzman's role in helping to establish that relationship with the Gateway Center and making sure that the Portland City Council had a direct and active role in addressing this pervasive problem in our community. So Dan, if you're out there, thank you for this leadership. And as you can see, the City Council continues to support it with a lot of passion. So thank you. Next up is item number 859 from the Bureau of Transportation.
Create a local improvement district to construct street, sidewalk, stormwater, sanitary sewer, and water main improvements in the Northwest Park Avenue and Johnson Kearney Streets Local Improvement District.
Colleagues, this is a second reading. We've already heard a presentation. We've had opportunities for public testimony. Is there anything else related to this particular item of business? Seeing none, Keelan, please call the roll.
Hugh Daly.
Thanks to PBOT staff for all your work on this. I vote aye.
Fritz.
Aye.
Ryan.
Aye.
Hardesty.
Aye.
Wheeler.
Aye. The ordinance is adopted. Next item, 860.
Authorize intergovernmental agreement with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality for the Columbia Slough Sediment Program not to exceed $325,000 over 5 years.
Commissioner Fritz.
Pulling up the right document. It just came up too. I was out of order on my agenda looking at, sorry. All right. So this is 860, right?
Yep, 860.
Thank you. Sorry about this.
Oh.
Okay, this ordinance would authorize Environmental Services to continue working under an intergovernmental agreement with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality to improve Columbia Slough sediment quality to protect public health and the environment in accordance with the requirements of the Department of DEQ's 2005 DEQ recorded decision for Columbia sluice sediments. In other words, we have to do this. The current agreement expires at the end of the year. This ordinance would authorize a new agreement not to exceed $325,000 for the next 5 years. Improving the health of the Columbia Slough watershed is a long-term effort. Data collected by the Bureau of Environmental Services has shown that contamination levels in sediment and fish tissue are improving, and sources of pollution are being identified and controlled. This agreement would be the fifth with DEQ since 1993, and BES and City Attorney's Office recommend its authorization to meet the city's environmental cleanup liability. Here today to answer any questions is Rod Struck, the Columbia Slough Sediment Program Manager with BES.
Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them. If not, we can move on.
I am not seeing anybody's hand raised. Thank you.
Great. Thanks.
All right. Does that complete your presentation?
Yes.
All right. We'll move to public testimony. Is there any public testimony, Keelan?
No one signed up for this item.
All right. Last chance on any questions. Seeing none, this is the first reading of a non-emergency ordinance. It moves to second reading. Thank you, Commissioner Fritz. Next item, 861, is the second reading.
Amend contract with CH2M Hill Engineers, Inc. to expand design, permitting, and construction support engineering services for the Columbia Boulevard Wastewater Treatment Plant Secondary Treatment Expansion Program. Project number E07947, not to exceed $14 million.
Colleagues, any further questions or discussion on this item? Seeing none, please call the roll.
You, Daly.
Aye.
Fritz.
Thanks to staff for the excellent presentation last week and for all your work on this. Aye.
Ryan.
Aye.
Hardesty.
I second what Commissioner Fritz just said. I thought they did an excellent presentation. They've set a high mark. We will hold them to it. I vote aye.
Wheeler.
Aye. The ordinance is adopted. Next up is 862, please.
Authorize competitive bid solicitation and contract with the lowest responsive and responsible bidder for construction of the Gabriel Park Play Area Improvements Project.
Commissioner Fritz.
Sorry, I'm just going to turn it over to staff for the presentation.
Very good. We have, looks like Gary's here. Good morning.
Good morning. Let me share my screen real quick if I could.
And Gary, if you could also just introduce yourself for the record, please. Yes. Thanks.
Hello, Mayor Wheeler, members of council. My name is Gary Dotka. I'm a capital project manager with Portland Parks and Recreation. I'm here today to request council's authorization for a competitive bid solicitation and contracting with the lowest responsive and responsible bidder for construction of the Gabriel Park Play Improvements Project. In my presentation today, I will share an overview of the project, our community engagement process, and how the project fits within the larger portfolio of Portland Parks and Rec's playground. This project is part of the 2014 Parks Replacement Bond that was generously passed by voters who approved the $68 million measure to address critical park needs without increasing tax rates, to address urgent needs in seven priority areas. This project fits into the playground's focus area and will renovate an existing playground that is outdated, deficient, and in need of replacement. I'm happy to say that this is the 10th bond playground project to go into construction, fulfilling the commitments made to voters in 2014. In addition to $1.7 million in bond funding, the project also received $2.5 million from Portland Parks and Rec system development charges to expand the playground and $110,000 from the Portland Parks and Rec ADA transition plan program's major maintenance general funds to address accessibility issues. The total project allocation for this project is $4.3 million. With the bond's commitment to replacement, not expansion, the additional funding has allowed PPR to amplify the bond investment by providing an expanded inclusive play area that advances the Bureau goals for providing inclusive play throughout the city. In 2014, PPR set an aspirational goal to provide one destination inclusive playground in each of the city's quadrants. Today we have three: the original Harper's Playground at Arbor Lodge Park in North Portland, completed in 2012, and the playground at Gateway Discovery Park, completed in 2018 in Northeast Portland, and Cooch Park, completed in 2019, just north of the downtown core in Northwest Portland. This project will be the fourth destination inclusive playground in Portland. And Gabriel Park is located in Southwest Portland, generally at Southwest 42nd and Southwest Vermont Street, near the intersections of the Maplewood, Hayhurst, and Multnomah neighborhoods. Acquired by Portland Parks and Rec in 1950, Gabriel Park is a 90-acre park with recreation opportunities for organized sports, picnicking, gardening, and more. This park also houses the Southwest Community Center. The project area in the northeast corner of the park, shown in the red box on your screen, the playground is located towards the center of this. There are several existing access points to the play area, with main access via the parking lot in the park and from on-street parking on Southwest Vermont Street. Public transit is also available at the corner of Southwest 37th and Southwest Vermont in the most northeast corner of the park. The project will provide much needed improvements for this well-used park. Installed in 1988 as part of the PPNR Gobi bond, the existing 2,800 square foot playground has limited play opportunities. The existing equipment does not meet current ADA standards. It lacks play value for collaborative and imaginative play and has ongoing maintenance concerns. Access between the parking lot and the restroom has many ADA challenges due to existing grades, and the restroom itself has insufficient accessible interior space. There are several picnic areas near this playground, though none currently meet ADA accessibility criteria, creating equity challenges for all users. This project will address these shortcomings. During design for this project, Portland Parks and Rec conducted an extensive community engagement process through a series of five project advisory committee meetings and three open houses. These meetings helped us to understand the current public use of the park, to connect with neighbors about the positive aspects of improving the park, and to solicit feedback and gain support for the design of the play area and other community needs. Additionally, Portland Parks and Rec Community Engagement Coordinator Maya Spencer hosted a meeting for the Somali woman on our project advisory committee and other Somali community members during Ramadan to ensure they too were able to participate in the process while being respectful of their family and community commitments. All PAC meetings and one of the community open house meetings were held at Stevens Creek Crossing, a home forward housing facility near Gabriel Park. This approach helped engage and include low-income and renter communities who often have more difficulty in attending early evening meetings. The remaining community open houses were held at Southwest Community Center within Gabriel Park. Since this project was focused on inclusive play, we wanted to center the voices of people experiencing disabilities and the voices of people of color. We were able to do this with a targeted selection process for the project advisory committee, resulting in a demographic composition that was important contribution to the success of this project. The advisory committee included members of which identified as 54% having experience living with disabilities themselves or in their families, or work closely with people with disabilities. 38% identified as BIPOC and immigrants and refugees, and 47% who are renters, including two members of our PAC that are residents at Stevens Creek Crossing. With community input and support, PPNR developed a final design that will construct park improvements focusing on accessible and inclusive play features such as slides, climbers, swings, balance play, rocking and spinning elements that challenge all users at their own highest level and allow for users to play and learn together regardless of their ability. Additional accessibility improvements include safety surfaces that provide access to all play equipment in an accessible way, picnic tables and benches in gathering spaces, drinking fountains, trash receptacles, and much needed bike racks for the playground. This project will also make accessibility improvements to the ADA parking stalls near the playground and to park pathways connecting the parking area, play area, existing restrooms, parking spaces on Vermont Street, and the TriMet stop at Southwest 37th and Southwest Vermont. PPR has an ongoing anticipated annual operations and maintenance amount of $13,320 to accommodate the play area size increase to 10,000 square feet. The design consultant team, led by Tuing Studio Landscape Architects, through their work, 61% of the $324,000 in contract fees were awarded to state certified DMWESB business enterprises. A disaggregation of the data for the spending shows that 85% of these fees went to firms certified as disadvantaged women-owned businesses, 10% to firms solely identifying as women-owned businesses, and 6% to emerging small businesses. So today we're here to request Council's authorization for competitive bid solicitation and contract with the lowest responsive and responsible bidder for construction of the Gabriel Park play area improvements. With the acceptance of this authority to bid by Council, we will proceed with advertisement to bid to commence early this fall. We anticipate construction start early 2021 and a completion date by winter of 2021. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Very good. We have a question from Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you for the excellent presentation, Gary. Let's go back to the demographic data that you provided. What do you mean when you say disadvantaged businesses? Can you demographically break that down more?
We could, and I'll need to get that information back to you. We broke it down into disadvantaged and women-owned businesses between those two. So I'll need to look into that and see what that means specifically.
So just so you know, I always am very interested in the demographic breakdown, and that means ethnic breakdown, racial breakdown, right? Because we tend to hide a lot of information.
Sure.
Using either emerging or disadvantaged businesses. That doesn't give me the info that I need.
Okay, we'll make sure to get that over to you.
Thank you. My next question has to do with your medium confidence in the cost for this development. And you've listed several reasons why you have medium confidence, including low contractor availability and the price risk from uncertainties and material supply chains, et cetera. Okay. So what happens if this ends up being significantly more than you have anticipated?
The medium confidence that we do have, we had cost estimates at each level of documentation for this project. So going into this, the project team has a good level of confidence. That doesn't always transpose into the contracting community. I think working with procurement, there are avenues, if this does come in significantly over our engineer's estimate, to work with procurement and the contractor. To find areas for value engineering that don't take away from our overall goals of inclusive play and providing access and equity for all users. That's something that we can look at with procurement if that does happen, or hopefully it does not.
Well, I mean, I would hope that you would also want to let the city council know, because procurement doesn't actually pass budgets, right? I would think you'd want to come back and let us know if the cost is going to be significantly higher, or if your goals around minority contracting and women contractors are not met.
Yeah,
I don't think procurement's the place where that conversation should happen.
So this is our authority to bid. Once we do have bids and we have an accepted final proposal cost, we will come back to City Council with procurement to do a procurement presentation. Procurement will break down all of the final costs and demographic information for our contractors. And I think that would be the time that we would present that revised cost number to City Council.
Thank you, Gary. One last question, which is really around the additional, let me see if I understand this correctly. Operations and maintenance costs will be increased by $13,320. Is that the total cost or is that just the increased cost?
That is our total cost that we are requesting for this coming fiscal year. That is the total cost, not an increase.
You're going to be requesting more general fund money after you do this redevelopment?
Nope, this is the total cost that we will be requesting of City Council for this development.
Maybe you and I are not speaking the same language. I'm not.
Okay. I apologize. Okay.
No, I think I got it. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you, Commissioner Hardesty. Commissioner Fritz.
Thank you very much for the presentation, Gary, and for indulging me as the outgoing commissioner. this has been really meaningful to both me and Commissioner Fish to get the accessible playgrounds done. I remember the opening of Cooch Playground, and thanks to Harper's Playground Organization and all of the community partners, it was great to hear you outline the community engagement from the folks nearby and from affected communities. So I'm just really excited about this. Wanted to point out, colleagues, that we're still missing one in Southeast Portland. So in order to be able to fulfill the pledge, this, as Gary said, completes the playground commitment from the bond measure. There will be a choice for the next Parks Commissioner to be able to use system development charges to do an inclusive playground in Southeast, hopefully. So just keep that on the to-do list in case any of you get assigned to be the Parks Commissioner. It's a really fun assignment, although challenging, of course, with all of the funding pressures that we have right now. So, thank you very much, Gary, for the presentation. I don't have a question. I just wanted to be enthusiastic. And I apologize for not being enthusiastic at the beginning. I was just like, I want to hear all about it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Commissioner Fritz. And I'm happy to present this project to you as our outgoing Parks Commissioner. We wish you the best.
Thank you, Commissioner. I don't know who is next. I'll call on Commissioner Udaly first, then Commissioner Ryan.
Thank you, Mayor. Well, I just want to commend Parks for really thinking beyond the minimal ADA compliance standards and for their ongoing commitment to improving accessible and inclusive recreation for people across our whole city. This was one of the first issues that I ever connected with the city on, probably about 12 years ago, when I had a 7-year-old who really loved parks and playgrounds, but whose options were extremely limited because he is a wheelchair user. And met Cody Goldberg around that time, who went on to found Harper's Playground and became a supporter of Harper's Playground. When we implement universal design standards, we are really designing spaces that are better for everyone. And as we know, some of our accessible and inclusive playgrounds are the most popular playgrounds in the city, which can provide challenges for kids like mine who need some extra time and space to really enjoy a playground. So the more we have the more access that families around the city have to these facilities, the better. Every kid should be able to enjoy inclusive, accessible play in their neighborhood parks. But having these really kind of grand, inclusive playgrounds scattered across the city is fantastic. So thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Ryan.
Yes, thank you, Gary. That was a great presentation. And then since Commissioner Fritz mentioned Southeast Portland, I'm obsessing over the parks now in Southeast Portland. Anyway, back to my point.
I'll never forget when my nephew and his wife came with their two kids, one named Harper, and they really just barely wanted to say hello to me. They just wanted to dash to this park, and it just opened. And so ever since then, I've been more tuned in. My question though is, I'm curious what nonprofits you reached out to do outreach, both with for wheelchair accessibility and with the Muslim community. Just there's some really good nonprofits, and I just wanted to hear who you were engaging.
Oh boy, thank you for the question, Commissioner Ryan, and it's nice to see you. I don't specifically have that information offhand. I would need to lean more on our community engagement coordinator, Maya Spencer, for that. I will talk a little bit about it. We did engage with Cody and Harper's Playground early on in the project to invite them to some of our early PAC meetings to present their philosophy and approach to inclusive design, because the parameters that I think we were able to set up with Harper's through the projects that we've partnered with them on are really, really the foundations for how I feel our project, this project at Gabriel Park, has moved forward using the framework that they've set up. And I think that's been an outstanding way for us to move forward on this. While we didn't partner with them specifically on this project, they did attend a few early meetings and, you know, spoke a little bit about what their thoughts were on the design to help move that forward. So I believe that was a very positive experience. We did engage with Fact Oregon to help solicit information and information for the groups. On our PAC, there was I apologize, I should have these names. There were folks from both PSU and from, I want to say Willamette University, but that could be wrong. I apologize. That work with folks that have special needs and are living with disabilities. So that was a very eye-opening experience, especially for myself on this project. You know, I think in some of our other work, focus on kids who get around with wheels has been a priority. So it's been nice to look at some of the sensory opportunities to help all kids, you know, touch and experience things visually in a different way. So that's been great. We used our community engagement liaisons, the CELs, for working with our Somali community. And we also reached out to the Autism Society of Oregon to help with understanding of how to best engage with people in that community.
Yeah,
that's cool. That's my real quick list.
No, thank
with,
you.
With tech support coming from Maya Spencer.
No, I just think it's so important when we hear that the city's community engagement efforts partner with nonprofits, because they already have a system set up. They already have the relationships with families. And so government doesn't need to duplicate that effort as much as just hitch on to the community organizations that exist. And I was thinking about Insight for those with mobility challenges, and then also, you know, Muslim Education Trust, just as a couple when I looked at those slides. So that was my curiosity. Thank you, Gary.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Ryan. Any further questions or comments before we open this up to testimony? Seeing none, very good. Keelan, do we have any public testimony on this ordinance?
No one signed up.
All right, very good. Gary, thank you. That was an excellent presentation. It's a terrific vision.
Thank you.
And Commissioner Fritz, thank you for your continued leadership. This is a first reading of a non-emergency ordinance. It moves to second reading. Next up is item 863, please, Keelan.
Amend permit fee schedules for building, electrical, land use services, mechanical, enforcement, plumbing, signs, site development, and land use service fee schedule for the hearings office.
Commissioner Ryan.
Yes, well, we had a riveting presentation last week and some really good back and forth with people that came to testify, and I'm thrilled about that. It also connects with an earlier item from technology. And so
is there someone from BDS here to add more to this?
Dan, that's not necessary. And I sort of,
I think we're just supposed to vote, right?
I put you on the spot. I neglected to note it was a second reading, but you did a great job. I was, for a guy who probably was not prepared to be called on, you really did a brilliant job. So periodically, I will test people just to make sure. This is, colleagues, a second reading. And as Commissioner Ryan accurately points out, we heard a great presentation on this. And we've had the opportunity for public testimony. Is there any further business or discussion on this item before we call the roll? And I'm not seeing any. So, Keelan, please call the roll.
Hugh Daly?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Ryan?
Yes, everything I just said, and aye.
Hardesty?
Aye.
Wheeler?
Aye. The ordinance is adopted. Thank you, Commissioner Ryan, and thank you to BDS. The last item on our agenda for this morning is 864, resolution.
Establish rules and limitations on Portland Police Bureau members subject to deputization by federal law enforcement agencies.
And before I turn this over, I just misspoke. I forgot we also have a 4/5 item at the end of the agenda. So this is the last regularly scheduled item. Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, colleagues. Let me just say that I believe that Mayor Wheeler did an excellent start and on making sure that Portland police officers who were deputized against our will and continue to be deputized against the city council's will understand that they in fact are employees of the city of Portland and they have an obligation to follow Portland's lead. I am going to turn it over to my esteemed colleague, Derek Bradley, and he's going to explain the resolution that is in front of us today, and I will have comments later. Derek, take it away.
Thanks, Commissioner. Thank you, Mayor, members of the City Council. For the record, my name is Derek Bradley, Policy Director to Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty. We have a brief presentation to get to public testimony as soon as possible. And I know that we'd like to end as close to noon as possible because I know there's a long afternoon. I'm going to go walk through the resolution pretty quickly here. Then we have two invited tests. Then Robert Taylor from the City Attorney's Office is going to speak briefly to the matter, fill in any holes I may have missed. And then we have two invited testimony speakers who will I'll introduce when it's time, and then we will go to public testimony. And I'll be here available to answer any questions, as obviously will Commissioner Harsey, and I think Robert Taylor will be available for questions as well. We got here in a very quick fashion. It was just about a month ago that everyone thought that we had completed a single night of having 56 Portland police officers federally deputized. Only to learn that that was not the understanding of the federal government. The city removed its consent for the deputation and seems in a pretty clear violation of well-established law, the federal government refused to end the deputation with the removal of our consent. The mayor issued an order to try and limit the interactions and involvement around the deputation of the Portland City, of the 56 officers of the PPB. Commissioner Harsey pointed out that that was a good start, and this should be viewed as a strengthening and expanding of that. A moment right before what could be a very contentious few weeks of reaffirming that, and an opportunity for all you on the City Council to make your statement and stand about what is an important issue. We saw the first federal charges brought to a local protester recently. It's in an OPB article from after the deputation. The real concern, the real problem attempting to be fixed here is that we do not want to see dozens, hundreds of Portlanders who are exercising their freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, and freedom of speech be arrested and charged with bogus federal crimes. It's a real concern with this. And you know, it's not inherently even necessary. This isn't an attempt to call out and demonize the 56 deputized officers. This is a matter of an intentionally confusing situation being created by the federal government for the potential of them to exploit. If you're a deputized officer, you're on the ground, there's a lot going on, there's a lot of confusion occurring, and a federal law enforcement officer comes up to you and says, you're deputized, you're a federal agent, I need you to go arrest that person right now. If there isn't a clear directive from city council, a clear order around this from city council, that might be a very difficult and confusing situation for that officer. So we've attempted to set clear guide rails with this, as well as create distance between the deputized officers and federal law enforcement to help prevent those types of situations from occurring, which I don't think anyone in the city of Portland is what they're hoping to have occur. So this resolution does a few things, some of which will sound very familiar if you followed the mayor's order. And one thing to highlight is these provisions relate specifically to deputized officers. Non-deputized officers in the PPB are able to conduct their normal business as long as they adhere to this, some, you know, the other laws that have existed, as well as the previous past federal limitations on federal cooperation. The measure will prevent deputized officers from taking action pursuant to the deputation, taking orders from federal agents or officials, making arrests or detentions under federal law, and unless authorized in writing by the mayor or police chief, communicate with federal agents in any capacity or crowd control matters. In addition, the resolution reaffirms local control over the PPB, lists critically important laws that all members of PPB are bound to follow, establishes reporting protocols if there is even an attempted order given to deputized officers by federal agents, and once again rejects any federal control over our local police force. One continued issue raised by the city attorney is the be it further resolved towards the end that forbids deputized officers from directly communicating with federal agents. The concern is that the best practice of law enforcement has been established to allow all responding law enforcement agencies to easily coordinate with one another. The problem being, if there's no way to do that, if someone gets injured, there's a potential for liability to the city. There are some release valves around this issue, though, in this resolution and the logistics around it. This concern is addressed by allowing non-deputized officers from interacting with federal law enforcement, including sergeants and incident commanders. You have sergeants on the ground, an incident commander that isn't deputized, these prohibitions don't apply to them. And if need be, it allows the police commissioner or chief of police to waive this requirement in writing and sent to city council. It would, you know, I think the intention would be that that would be a very clear line of taking responsibility should there be arrests of Portlanders and charging a federal crime. But that's how we sort of covered that issue. It had been our hope to make these requirements even stricter, but the threat of lawsuits against the city, should someone get hurt, led the commissioner, as well as, you know, very real logistical challenges, led the commissioner to decide that this was the best course of action. Now to fill it, to provide any further background or just anything else that he thinks should be highlighted, I'd like to invite Robert Taylor to speak on the matter.
Thanks, Derek. For the record, my name is Robert Taylor, Chief Deputy City Attorney. I thought Derek did a great job of covering the resolution and the terms of it, and in particular, highlighting the be it resolved regarding communication and coordination, and the concern around best practices of responding agencies being able to communicate and cooperate, and highlighting the safety valve that is in there for the police commissioner and police chief. And I know folks are hoping to get out of here by noon, and there is public testimony. So if there are questions, I'm here to answer those.
Thanks, Robert. And I think questions will, after testimony, at least after invited testimony, see whenever the commissioners want, obviously. But for now, I would like to invite our first speaker, Andrea Valderrama with ACLU.
Thank you, Derek and Mayor Wheeler and members of the Portland City Council. My name is Andrea Valderrama, and I am the new policy director and registered lobbyist with the ACLU of Oregon. The ACLU of Oregon is a nonprofit organization dedicated to defending and advancing civil liberties and civil rights. With more than 47,000 members, we fight for free speech, racial justice, criminal justice reform, religious liberty, reproductive rights, LGBTQ rights, immigrants' rights, and more. I am a first-generation Peruvian American. Growing up, I would often hear stories of the political unrest and state-sanctioned violence toward activists like my family, and have always been deeply grateful for the privileges afforded to me in this country. Never would I have expected, however, that now as a mother here in Portland, some of those same rights my family risked their lives for are in jeopardy. The right to protest peacefully, the right to unequivocally say Black Lives Matter and Si Se Puede, and the right to march in coalition with fellow community activists without being hauled off in an unmarked car without due process. These rights would continue to be at risk if the Portland City Council does not pass this resolution, limiting crowd control efforts by federally deputized Portland Police Bureau members. As leading experts in the defense of civil liberties and civil rights, the ACLU of Oregon urges you to vote yes and to pass this resolution for the following three reasons. One, Audre Lorde wrote, "The master's tools will never dismantle the master's house." Allowing federally deputized officers to arrest and charge Portlanders would increase state-sanctioned violence. Local Black-led organizations like Unite Oregon and Imagine Black, formerly PELF, have been clear. Demilitarize, defund, and divest. The same administration putting children in cages, killing Black men, trans women, and children, and giving orders to white supremacist organizations is ordering this deputation. They will never dismantle their own house, but we can. Two, police violence is hate violence. Portland United Against Hate and the Coalition of Communities of Color recently released this report documenting the dozens of accounts of hate violence from law enforcement. Our concern is the potential increase in these incidences should deputized officers be allowed to engage in crowd control. Three, questionable federal charges have already been mounted against Portlanders, and our concern is that the federal government will continue to push the bounds of its authority. The city was right to mount a legal challenge against the federal government's attempt to quell protests, and this resolution is also necessary to ensure Portlanders can defend themselves against federal abuses of power. Without exhausting all available avenues to reject federal deputations, we leave the door open for federal authorities to continue to violate the rights of the city and its residents alike. While we support this resolution, there are areas we would have liked to see it go further. For example, in addition to prohibiting communications with marshals or FPS agents without prior written authorization, deputized officers should also be prohibited from communicating with ICE, CPB, or other DHS agents without prior authorization. There should be clear accountability mechanisms should officers disregard this resolution or the police commissioner. Any participation in unified command or other interagency response to protests should be documented in a memorandum of understanding that is available to the public and informs the public of the policies guiding the unified approach. PPB should also be prohibited from entering any MOU that permits PPB officers to engage in types of force currently prohibited by Oregon law, Portland policy, or court order. To ensure that the goals of this resolution are met and the federal government cannot abuse deputations to violate the rights of people in Portland, limiting federally deputized officers to desk duty, especially those without crowd control training, would be ideal to ensure the best protection of civil liberties. While prohibited from policing protests, federally deputized officers should also undergo mandatory crowd control de-escalation, implicit bias, inequity training, that educate officers about how white supremacy formed and supports modern American policing, including the PPB. Additionally, we urge the city to promote transparency around the deputization of officers and make publicly available all current and future agreements or arrangement that the PPB have with federal and local agencies. Finally, I would like to thank Commissioner Hardesty for her leadership and for bringing this forward. The ACLU of Oregon looks forward to continuing to work with your office and all of the commissioners in the mayor's office in realizing a new vision for Portland where Black and Brown lives matter, where the right to protest harmful institutions is protected rather than met with an arsenal of weapons, and where police violence ends. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Andrea. Let me call your attention to the fourth be it resolved from the bottom. Even though we are a sanctuary city, we did put all that into this resolution just to reaffirm our continued commitment to not work with ICE, and to remind ourselves that we are in fact a sanctuary city and should act like one. So thank you so much. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Derek, who's next?
Thanks again, Andrea. That was great. Next, we have Franz Bruggemeier from Oregon Justice Resource Center.
Thank you all for having me today. My name is Franz Bruggemeier. I'm a staff attorney at the Oregon Justice Resource Center. As many of you know, we do work around criminal justice reform and represent many of those who have been harmed by Portland police actions during the protests since George Floyd was murdered 5 months ago. We urge the City Council to support the important resolution from Commissioner Hardesty to limit the destructive effects of the unconstitutional federal deputization. We agree with Andrea's proposals and suggestions and urge the City Council to look further into those. Over the last 5 months of protests, and of course, even before that, we have seen a city police force that has shown that it refuses to be accountable to its police commissioner, has refused to be accountable to the community, and this is simply one more way for PPB to ignore the will and the direction of the community it is supposed to serve. The ongoing federal deputization and enforcement of federal law causes further erosion of what little trust the community may have in PPB. Excuse me. May have in PPB and what little credibility PPB has left as a community safety organization. At the same time, there's no public safety benefit to having PPB officers on the streets who are able to enforce federal law. The state laws that aim to protect police and others are more than sufficient to do so. Our state does not allow police officers to enforce federal law in the context of immigration laws, so why would we allow our police, local police, to enforce federal law and work with federal prosecutors to punish people who can already be held accountable under those state laws? DA Schmidt has not done anything to show that he would not prosecute people who are arrested for assaulting officers. He has merely recognized that the reality that almost all of the arrests of protesters for non-crime are for non-crimes, and that it would be a waste of resources, city resources and time, to try to bring these non-crimes before a jury. The federal deputization also usurps DA Schmidt's community-granted authority and again decreases local accountability. It is terrifying that we've gotten to the point where our city police officers are now unconstitutionally enforcing federal law simply to allow for greater punishment for those protesters expressing their rights and their ability to ask for changes. We have been told that the will of the city is irrelevant and that deputized officers can enforce federal law rather than what they are employed to do if they so choose. That is anti-democratic and unconstitutional. I and OJARC would advocate for each officer who has been deputized to be taken off the streets by placing them on desk duty or even suspended until that deputization is over. Those officers have been hired to work for our community, not to be the illegal stormtroopers of a wannabe strongman who has no understanding of American government or basic democracy. That said, I want to thank Commissioner Hardesty for her continued recognition of this ongoing harm and thank her for being an elected leader who is responding appropriately to these threats. I urge the City Council to adopt Commissioner Hardesty's resolution and continue to do everything it can to end this unconstitutional usurpation and destruction of accountability and trust. Thank you.
And thank you, Franz. Before opening this up to public testimony, I would like to thank ACLU and Oregon Justice Resource Center, as well as Portland Cop Watch, for being valuable resources during the drafting of this resolution. And finally, I'd like to thank Robert Taylor from the City Attorney's Office for all his hard work and help with this issue. He was really invaluable in this. I'm available for questions now or after public testimony.
Not seeing any hands up, so maybe we should go to public testimony.
Public testimony, Keelan. How many folks do we have signed up?
We have 10 people on the call to testify.
Very good. 2 minutes each, please. Name for the record.
Emery Mort.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
You're good to go.
Okay, good morning, Council. My name is Emery Mort. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I know everyone's getting ready for lunch. I want to urge the Council to put the strongest constraints possible on the deputizing of local PPD officers as federal agents. It is probably necessary to place deputized PPB officers actually on desk duty, as OJRC just said. After trying to understand what happened with all this deputizing, I'll try to speak into the public record what seems to have happened, and the rest is in my submitted written testimony. And quickly before that, I want to just say the Portland budget vote needs to be held before the upcoming November 3rd election. Back in June, 700 people signed up, but only like 300 people testified. So I think the hearing tonight could conclude with a vote, and I urge you to do that. So back to deputizing the agents. PPB Deputy Chief Davis was on a PSEP call last night. He confirmed that this deputization order, it actually came from Oregon State Police Superintendent Travis Hampton, which many of you probably know. So this is a problem. Travis Hampton and the governor who delivered the order and DOJ have refused elected officials' strong demands to undo the order. This is a bad precedent for us, for other jurisdictions. And frankly, it seems like the police are leveraging this with the city in retaliation over the, you know, electorate voting for people like District Attorney Schmidt. So the September 26th deputation order was approved by Chief Lavelle with no public input at the last minute. So the city was in need of a unified police response. And then suddenly this deputation was announced for the rest of the year. So this is just bad faith. It was supposed to be about protecting officers. I don't think it is. According to Davis, it allows officers to make federal arrests when in the nexus of a federal building or a federal issue. And this just seems like an order that is in the nexus of being broad, chilling due to its vagueness and needs to be opposed as strongly as possible. Folks brought up the OPB story about an 18-year-old from Southwest who was outside ICE the other night in October. He was arrested on federal charges for—
Emery, your time is up.
Okay, jabbing someone with an umbrella. So I guess I went over time. Thank you for taking this testimony. I hope you pass this and then pass the stronger things that ACLU and OJRC said. So thank you so much. Bye.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Edith Gillis.
Hi, Edith.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
I want you to realize that while the budgetary impact of this, if obeyed and amended to close the huge loopholes, would not just be non-significant, but would be a significant positive impact on the budget by reducing the amount of money we waste on personnel, weapons, ammo, lawsuits, property damage, violent crimes by Portland police, and it's a lost credibility and cooperation with citizens and their ability and willingness to pass bond levies and pay taxes and provide in-kind services through volunteerism, et cetera. So this will have a positive impact if obeyed and amended as follows. This must be immediately amended to also ban Portland police employees and G4S security contractors with the city from working with or allowing access to information or intelligence gathering equipment or resources to or with militias, fascist groups, corporations, other agencies and nations to directly or indirectly gather, analyze, relay, communicate, or make available data, intelligence and information or the equipment by which that is gathered. And do not to be engaged in criminal, of those Portlanders not engaged in criminal activity, it's not violating city codes during protests or involving protesters. Ban the Portland Police Bureau employees from having outside employment with other law enforcement or as security or as intelligence gathering for other entities. Amended to specify Portland Police Bureau and security contractors are to obey ORS 181A.250 outlined spying by local agencies or providing that info to or during the work of federal agencies or officers. Require all PPB and city contracted G4S employees to protect the human rights and civil liberties of Portlanders during and related to protests and to exercise equal, safe, fair, humane enforcement. It'd be a real change from the last entirety of their existence. I'm concerned about hearing and reading that Portland Police Bureau has refused over the last 6 months to report and analyze and discipline internally and promptly, fully, accurately report to the City Council, Public, and DA all use of force by Portland Police Bureau and their contractors related to protests. I'm concerned that the city has still refused to give me copies of my 911 calls when the Portland Police committed violent crimes and
practices. Yes, your time is up.
I'm concerned that the city must ban all city employees and their contractors from silencing and punishing free speech, public assembly, or demand or address reasons. We must require all federally deputized officers and city contracted G4S security to not be on the streets or giving info during the protests or access to the information.
Thank you, Edith.
You must have the extended testimony. And
next up, we have Marlene Howell.
Good morning.
Can you hear me?
Yep, loud and clear. You sound
okay.
Good.
I fully support Commissioner Hardesty's proposal, and I ask that each of you look in the mirror and ask yourselves, is this who I am? Is this who Portland is? Is this who I want Portland to be when you consider any of our officers being federalized? They do not make me as a white woman safer, and they make brown and black Portlanders much less safe than I am. And so I really implore you to consider who are we and who are we becoming, and use your leadership to take some important political risks and do what is best for Portlanders who are the most marginalized in the political system. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Dan Handelman.
Hi, Dan.
Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. I'm Dan Handelman with Portland Cop Watch. I just want to clarify quickly that we did not see this resolution until it was posted, so we did not help draft it. I'm sure timelines are getting very confusing these days. While we're generally supportive of the goal of the resolution around deputization, which is to create the most intense restrictions possible on Portland police cooperating with or being agents of federal law enforcement for crowd control purposes, we want to be clear that Portland Cop Watch does not support heavy-handed crowd control tactics, whether they are performed by local or federal police. We emphasize here that control over those police comes from the elected civilian leadership, who should not hide behind those violent state-sponsored tactics to perpetuate the inequalities in our society, while wondering where community members might have gotten the notion that property damage, like slicing tires, or violence, like the use of batons, chemical agents, and firearm-launched projectiles, are ways to resolve conflict. Regarding the language of the resolution, in the Be It Further Resolved paragraph listing 6 items Portland officers have to follow, even if under federal command, one more item should be included, ORS 181A250, which prohibits collection or maintenance of police people's social, political, or religious affiliation without suspicion of criminal conduct. Like the other 6 items listed, which cite specific state laws, city resolutions, and a PPB directive, the addition of ORS 181A250 will further clarify the framework in which PPB members may legally interact with federal law enforcement agencies. Without reminding officers of this, they can be asked by federal agents to identify individuals in the crowd and what they know about their affiliations merely for intelligence gathering rather than criminal investigation purposes. Portland needs to guarantee not just the physical safety, but also the civil rights of its community members. We urge you to add this clarification to the resolution. I also want to add that Attorney General Bill Barr ordered Joint Terrorism Task Forces to investigate the Black Lives Matter organizers, which is an indication that 181A250 is going to be violated by the federal agents, and that the Oregon State Police somehow were the ones that decided to federally deputize Portland Police, and this resolution contemplates that happening again if the governor orders unified command, and we're hoping that that does not expand the number of deputized officers. The resolution seems to allow for that. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Diane Meisenhelter.
Can you hear me?
Yes, now we can.
Okay, sorry about that.
No worries.
Okay,
So nationally, we are in an unprecedented presidential election in which the incumbent candidate has threatened to take power by not counting all votes and or ignoring the vote if he loses. This threat comes at a time of voter suppression and intimidation in the midst of a racial justice uprising that has been underway in Portland and across the nation for months. If the president's threats materialize, there'll be large outpourings in defense of democracy in Portland and across the country. I urge you to support Council Member Hardesty's resolution to put rules and limitations on Portland police deputized as federal agents. Oregon State Troopers and Portland police were deputized as U.S. Marshals in support of federal law enforcement, particularly so-called Homeland Security, a branch known to be particularly heinous in its candor, policies, politics, and human rights abuses. Those deputized can now make arrests which can carry arbitrary federal charges from the Trump-appointed U.S. District Attorney. This undermines democratically elected Multnomah County District Attorney Schmidt's decision to only prosecute demonstrators for deliberate property damage, theft, or the use of threat or force against another. By allowing deputized officers to arrest protesters, the city could well be complicit in the rollout of what is a repressive tool in Trump's playbook of sending federally deputized marshals into urban areas to quell protests of his plausible refusal to abide by the results of the election. I'm part of the recently formed Defend Democracy Coalition of over 40 organizations who vow nonviolent protests to ensure that every vote is counted and election irregularities are impartially investigated and remedied. We've submitted a petition from our group to City Council and urge you to stand with us as our electeds to ensure fair elections and our constitutional rights. We encourage City Council members to be individual signatories and adopt this petition as a council resolution. We urge the mayor to do the right thing, holding firm against Governor Brown's threats by maintaining the tear gas ban, not inviting deputized state troopers in, and not supporting militarized responses or less lethal munitions. Diana, I further, okay, I just wanna say that I can't be there this afternoon, but I support Commissioner Hardesty's incredible efforts in these regards, and also the effort to substantially reduce the police budget towards community reinvestment and rethinking how we do real, effective public safety. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Shelby Wallman.
Good afternoon.
Can you hear me?
Yep, loud and clear.
Hey, my name is Shelby Wallman. I'm the founder of Back the Blue PDX and Back the Blue PDX Public on Facebook. I'm going to be a lot different than everybody else, so please bear with me. I'm a proud American, strong 2A advocate, business owner, community member, and previously armed security officer. City Council has been feeding into a rhetoric that police are bad. We're in a bad situation with police. Emergency calls are taking hours to respond to. Our officers are limited on their days off. Their families are being threatened. All of this just because a group of criminals died at the hands of police. A white police officer is 18% more likely to be shot and killed by a black male. 14 unarmed black individuals have died in 2019 from police. 25 unarmed white individuals killed by police in 2019. Unarmed does not mean not dangerous. Officers have been injured and we've lost friends who some call family, Anthony J. Danielson, at the hands of these so-called peaceful protesters. Hospitals like OHSU and Providence are allowing their own staff to protest, some going as far as helping with medical aid. When does the violence end? First, you guys cut the budget by $15 million. Now you want to take more officers off the street because they are federally deputized. What are you guys thinking? These officers got deputized because of fear-mongering Joanne and Ted have done. Joanne and Ted have personally called violence to Back the Blue events. They've called the Proud Boys and my Back the Blue groups white nationalists, Nazis, and other dishonest and disrespectful terms. I've personally reached out to Ted and Joanne's teams to invite them to our events. Surprised those officers have gone on deaf ears. When is our elected officials going to represent every Portlander? In Portland, our DA won't even uphold the law and keep people accountable. How do you honestly feel like we will get justice in Portland when our DA isn't even willing to talk to a group of conservatives? I went to his office yesterday and he wouldn't even make time to come out and speak to us. He was so scared he wouldn't even walk out the front door. Portland desperately needs federal government to come in and clean house before somebody else does. Please allow the National Guards to help. When are we going to bridge the gap and unite instead of continuously continue with this division. This is an offer to Ted and Joanne. I'm more than willing to talk to your teams and unite both groups if you guys are willing to. But the violence on both ends needs to stop.
Your time is up.
With that, I'm concluded. Thank you.
Thank you, Shelby. I don't agree with everything you said, but we hear and appreciate all perspectives here. So thank you for giving your perspective.
Next up, we have Lynn Handlin.
Good afternoon, Lynn.
Okay, there. Did that work?
Yeah, you're sounding okay. Good, Lynn.
Yeah, I'm here in support of the Resolution 864, and especially if we can add on the addendum to assign the federalized officers to desk duty. That way, you know, it's better for them because then they're not confused about what they're doing. It's time to end the use of federally deputized police officers. The Portland police already had little or no accountability, and now some have been given even more power and even less accountability. We saw what happened when Portland was invaded this summer by federal police, massive escalation of violence against protesters, and a large increase in the number of people on the streets angry about this gross violation of our rights and overreach of the government. This use of federalized police against citizens, especially in Democratic majority cities during this election time, is exactly what the current administration wants, creating more unrest and inevitably leading to more violence against nonviolent protesters. Pouring fuel on the fires set by the actions of police, police violence against Black and Brown people leading to ever more violence. Some of the officers who murdered Michael Reinall were federally deputized, and that did not go well. The rule of law, due process, a trial, anything approaching justice were thrown out the window with the full support of the federal police and their leader, Donald Trump, cheering on the retribution exacted by these people. Mayor Wheeler has said that he does not want the federal police in Portland. I assume this includes federalized local police. Let's see that desire made policy. Do not use any of these federalized officers during this election time at all. Perhaps put them on suspension until after the election time, or really ever. Nothing good will come of this. This is a chance for the city of Portland, City Council of Portland to stand up to criminally corrupt, racist, authoritarian administration and tell them no, not in Portland, not anymore, enough is enough. Thank you.
Thank you, appreciate it.
Next up we have Kristen Gross.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep, you're good.
All right, thank you for allowing me to speak on this, and thank you to Commissioner Hardesty for bringing up this issue. We've seen the first instance of someone being charged federally because of an interaction with a PPB officer. An 18-year-old is charged because he was holding an umbrella towards heavily armed officers. The city chose not to pursue charges, and this should have been the end of this case. Instead, this person will potentially have their life ruined all for holding an umbrella. These are just the beginnings of the consequences of federally deputizing local officers. These are also PPB, not federal officers, and I'm appalled that deputizing is even an option. These deputizations are just a tool of the federal government to further their fascist agenda and to allow them to circumvent our DA, who has often chosen not to prosecute peaceful protesters. This rise of fascism should be concerning to all elected officials, as the goal is to suppress anyone who has opinions in conflict with the federal government. I urge the city to do everything in their power to limit and ban these deputizations. And I also support moving all officers to desk duty who are still federally deputized. Thank you, and I cede the rest of my time.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Hyung Nam.
Welcome.
Hello?
Hi.
I'm Hyung Nam. I'm with Portland Metro People's Coalition, and I also teach political economy and social studies. And I'm testifying today in support of this resolution, and also want to emphasize the suggested emphasis and amendments from the ACLU, Oregon Justice Resource Center, and Portland Cop Watch. As a social studies teacher, I know that this country has a long history of political repression and surveillance, and it's not just Trump. We've seen this both by federal police and officials and local police. We've had our own Red Squad here for decades. that have wasted public resources on spying and surveillance on all kinds of people for really no reason except for collecting dirt on people. We need to make sure that we completely sever the ability of the feds to use their power right now, especially under Trump, to come after a city that they've clearly targeted. We already know that our own cops, there's no trust of our own cops from their own 2019 Strategic Insights report. This will make things even worse. And furthermore, crowd control policing by local or federal cops is ineffective, as well documented by many experts, including many of the experts that testified in the Oregon State Legislature this summer. And in fact, that kind of policing is not only counterproductive to public safety, it actually incites violence and causes harm to both those officers, the public, and actually to our environment now. Furthermore, there is a major issue of risk management. I want to make sure that we don't shortchange victims, families, or survivors for all the lawsuits and settlements for the harm that our police, whether federally deputized or not, do. But we want to make sure that we stop the harm from happening more in the future. We're already facing a record number of risk management cases and torts. So I want to emphasize that we need to put the 56 rapid response team officers on desk duty, not have—
Your time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Reverend Bill Sinkford.
Welcome.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
I am Reverend Bill Sinkford, Senior Minister at First Unitarian Church, located at 12th and Salmon, and I am here to speak in support of Commissioner Hardesty's proposals to place restraints on the officers that have been federally deputized, and to thank her for her ongoing leadership. I bring two concerns. The first is a public safety concern. I believe that next week, regardless of where the election stands, thousands of Portland residents will be called to the streets to exercise guaranteed rights to assembly and speech. I don't think there is any doubt about this at this point. And I believe that presence on the streets will blend with the ongoing protests. We have experience. We know that having federal troops or federally deputized troops on the streets serves to increase the likelihood of confrontation and violence. The federal presence functions like an accelerant. It makes things worse. Why would this city choose to make the situation on our streets more dangerous, to make it worse? Keeping these officers off the streets is first and foremost, for me, a public safety concern. Second, the presence of these officers on the streets and the increased likelihood of violence that can be anticipated, that presence will serve to chill the right of citizens to gather and raise their voices. Their presence on the street will work against the functioning of our democracy at a time when our democracy needs all the support that we can give it. I would also mention the possibility, the very real possibility, if this resolution is not approved, of the ongoing damage to our image as a progressive and progressively governed city. That is also of great concern to me, and I believe of you as well. I hope that that you will endorse this resolution, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak and for your careful deliberation and for your service. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's all we have for today.
All right, good. Colleagues, questions? I'd like to just make a few brief comments if I could. First of all, I want to remind people why we're here and why we're discussing this resolution. You will recall that several weeks ago when there was a demonstration, the state police took control of the situation. That was done with our understanding in advance. It was a partnership between the state, between Multnomah County and the city of Portland in a mutual aid agreement. There were several discussions leading up to that mutual aid agreement, including what the rules of partnership would be. At some point over the course of the weekend, a decision was made to deputize Portland police officers and perhaps others. That decision was an important decision that should have been made with an elected official making that decision and participating in that process. I remind people that the city charter assumes civilian oversight of the Portland Police Bureau, and on important matters, it is for that reason that we have a commissioner in charge. That happens to be me at this particular moment, or at a minimum, one of the other elected officials in our local government should have been participatory in that decision. That was not the case. When I, as police commissioner, learned about the deputization, I acted quickly. I sent a clear directive to Chief Lavelle indicating that we were no longer deputizing those individuals, because I was particularly surprised to learn that the deputization didn't just last for the duration of the event. That event was defined clearly by the duration of the governor's emergency declaration, which brought all of these different law enforcement agencies together. And the decision was apparently made at some point to deputize these officers, not just for the declared emergency or the duration of the event, but in fact, for the remainder of my first term as the mayor of Portland. That obviously is not the way we engage with other agencies around mutual aid. That is not the kind of professionalism that I would like to see being exhibited between different levels of government. At a minimum, that is a decision that we should have participated in. And my request to, well, it wasn't a request, my directive to the police bureau to end the deputization operationally has done so. But now there is a legal dispute between the federal government and the city of Portland as to whether or not we have the right to withdraw that deputization. I would argue that operationally it's already been done through my directive. We will obviously have to resolve this issue in court. If we cannot resolve it amicably prior to this going to court, I'm not sure that this resolution necessarily adds anything of import to the discussion, except that I will absolutely support it, because I believe the more that we say uniformly that it is a decision that we need to make here locally, it's a decision that needs to be made with elected officials being in the loop about important decisions, that I will support it. I also want to say this: operationally, there may be reasons why it makes sense in limited circumstances for limited durations for Portland police officers to be deputized. But before that decision is made, we need to have a conversation about it. We need to understand the facts. We need to be participants in understanding what the issues are and why there is a need for deputization. And ultimately, we have to make that decision. Somebody who is elected at the local level needs to be responsible for that decision, whether it is myself as police commissioner or whether it's a decision of the city council. We need to be at the table. So I intend to support this. I'm hopeful that we don't have to go all the way to court to resolve this matter with the federal government. I hope that they will acknowledge that this is an important issue of local control. And I hope they hear what I just said, that there may be operational reasons to deputize on a limited basis for a limited duration. But that is ultimately a decision that we should make at the local level, not a decision that's made on our behalf by officers of the federal government. Commissioner Hardesty, you have your hand raised.
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mayor. Thank you. Mayor, I'd like to add a, I'd like to amend the resolution and add a section. I will read it. Be it further resolved, section that lists six laws all Portland Police Bureau members must follow. I'd like to add a seventh, and it's ORS 181A.250, which prohibits collection or maintenance of people's social, political, or religious affiliations without suspicion of criminal conduct. And if I could get a second?
Second.
It's been moved in second. And I want to say that Robert Taylor has been able to review this amendment. The clerk has the amendment. So I guess the next step would be to vote on the amendment.
Commissioner Hardesty, I'd like to ask legal counsel a question about this amendment. I have not seen this amendment previously. This is a new amendment. Robert, could you give us some indication of what the implications are of this? It sounds entirely reasonable, but I want to make sure there is not some operational issue here that we're overlooking.
Thank you, Mayor. Robert Taylor, Chief Deputy City Attorney. We have reviewed that language, and it does not raise any concerns for us. That be it further resolved section lists directives that are currently in effect and applicable to members of the police bureau, and the purpose of listing them there is to just amplify and remind bureau members that they remain in effect. And the statute cited and the language cited by Commissioner Hardesty is consistent with that.
So this, to be clear then, this is language that is consistent with existing directives and policies within the police bureau. So we don't actually engage currently in the activities that are described here as being prohibited.
That is correct, Mayor. That statute is at issue in a piece of pending litigation that the city is involved in regarding the live streaming of demonstrations, but inserting that language into this resolution just makes it clear that that statute does apply as the rest of the directive.
So it is a reinforcement of existing policy and statute. And I also want to clarify that we are not currently live streaming demonstrations. Is that correct? Aren't we under a temporary restraining order on that point?
We're under a temporary restraining order to follow that statute, and as a result, we are no longer doing the live streaming.
Okay, thank you. That clears up my questions. Colleagues, any other questions?
Mayor, I just want to say that this is also in response to the recommendation made by Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch, and I already knew that this was law, but I think it makes the public feel comfortable knowing that we are reinforcing laws that already should be followed because they're already part of the operating procedures with Portland Police.
Yeah, I have no objection to that. And Robert, wouldn't it also be true that through this council vote, I made my position perfectly clear with regard to how the deputization came about and my strong belief in local control and participation in those decisions going forward. Does this resolution in effect strengthen our case insofar as it shows that we are unified on this issue, assuming that we are?
Mayor, it does. And your description of how the deputation occurred and is accurate, and it was immediately terminated following that weekend by the Portland City Attorney. As of that date, it's the city's legal position that the deputation is no longer in force and effect. The federal government refused to recognize that. That's the source of the dispute. We are currently suing the federal government over that issue. But this resolution by council would provide further evidence of the city's position that the deputation is unconstitutional and of no further force and effect.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Robert. Colleagues, any further questions on this item? This is a resolution. Keelan, please call the roll.
Mayor, did you want to call the roll on the amendment?
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. Thank you. Please call the roll on Commissioner Hardesty's amendment to add the last section.
Thank you, Daly.
Aye.
Fritz.
Did I get called?
I'll assume I got called. I didn't hear it, but I'm Amanda Fritz, and I am voting on this. And thank you, Dan Handelman and Portland Cop Watch, for sending this in yesterday evening, and Commissioner Hardesty for putting it forth as an amendment. Aye.
Ryan.
Ryan, you're muted.
Aye.
I heard him.
Hardesty.
Aye.
Wheeler.
Insofar as this amendment is a restatement of existing policies and procedures, I have no reason to oppose it. I vote aye. The amendment's adopted. To the main motion is amended. Please call the roll.
You, Daly.
Before I give my official closing remarks, I feel the need to comment on some testimony we heard today. This ordinance is about local control of our police bureau. And it is related to the ongoing protests we're seeing against police violence and in defense of Black lives. We heard testimony today characterizing victims of police violence as criminals, which is false. And even in the event when someone has a prior record or is suspected of being engaged in criminal activity, they have a right to due process. All of us do. And that right is denied when a police officer takes it upon themselves to be the judge, jury, and executioner. So I have a hard time letting false statements stand on public record without responding to them. Everyone knows that. And that's what I have to say about that. So thank you, Commissioner Hardesty, for bringing this resolution. It is clear that this administration has no respect for local authority, particularly when the locality in question happens to be primarily and proudly Democratic. We cannot reasonably believe that this administration will not abuse the federal deputation of our local officers. It is especially concerning that the deputation will be in place during the presidential election, when we've seen Trump's willingness to use every tool at his disposal to undemocratically tip the election in his own favor and prematurely cast aspersions on election results. We cannot take the chance that local officers will be pawns in these actions. It was this very concern that led me to introduce the first resolution barring collaboration between local and federal officers. Today's resolution clarifies that the feds do not have authority to commandeer PPB officers, that officers are not permitted to comply with any attempts to do so, and that if they do, there will be consequences. I hope that we don't have to enforce this resolution, but unfortunately, we've all seen that hope will not be enough to stop the corrupt aims of this administration. Thank you again, Commissioner Hardesty, for asserting our authority and expectations of officers regarding the federal deputation. I vote aye.
Fritz.
Aye.
Ryan.
Yes, I'm glad this was brought forward. I like accountability. The closer it is to the ground, the better the government responds to the services that are needed. I support this resolution. Thank you, Mayor Wheeler, for the context. I recall those phone calls over that weekend. You acted as we'd want our mayor and police commissioner to act. And thank you, Commissioner Hardesty, for bringing this forward. Aye.
Hardesty.
Thank you all, colleagues, for supporting this resolution. I wish that we could, in fact, put those officers on desk duty until their deputization was done. That would be my preference. I also wish we could have made this resolution stronger. But again, due to legal advice, we tried to walk a very fine line. And I want the public to know that the entire city council is united and saying that we don't have any police officers working on behalf of the federal government. I am very happy to vote aye.
Wheeler.
Aye. The resolution is adopted as amended. Don't hang up anybody. We have a 4/5 item. Pursuant to City Code 3.02.040(i)(8), I move to suspend the rules and immediately hear this agenda item related to the filing of the lawsuit to protect the personal cell phone numbers of city employees from release under a public records request. Bala Negrist from the City Attorney's Office will provide background on this agenda item. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mayor and Council members, and thank you so much for hanging on. I know this is late in the first morning session, but I'll try and be brief to describe the resolution. So this item is presented from the City Attorney's Office in order to file a lawsuit in Multnomah County Circuit Court as an appeal from a district attorney's position that the city turn over personal cell phone numbers as part of a public records request. That public records request was for city SMARSH records, which those SMARSH is the company that the city utilizes to maintain a database of text messages and other phone information from city issued devices. The city, in responding to that public records request, had redacted personal cell phone numbers of city employees. And so an example of why personal cell phone numbers may be in those records is employees may, for example, text their supervisor when they're sick or to arrange for a meeting. And particularly with COVID-19 and so much of our workforce moving to working from home, many city employees have relied on their personal cell phone numbers to contact supervisors and other city employees who have city-issued cell phone numbers. The district attorney ordered us to turn over those personal cell phone numbers. However, the city believes, the city attorney's office believes that at least two public records exemptions apply in this case. And we believe that the district attorney misapplied those laws in order to order us to turn over those personal cell phone numbers. The reason this has been filed as a 4/5 agenda item is because there's a short turnaround time for the city to file an appeal in Multnomah County Circuit Court. Our lawsuit and complaint must be filed no later than Tuesday of next week. I'm happy to answer any questions that council may have on the lawsuit, the underlying public records request, or any other items. Thank you.
Colleagues, any questions? Not seeing any public testimony on this item. Oh, Commissioner Udaly snuck in there. Hi, Commissioner.
Hi. Thank you for that. I do have a question for attorneys. I'm so perplexed by this lawsuit, and I'm struggling to understand how we could... How do I put this? I think city employees have a right to privacy, and they were certainly not informed that their personal information would be a matter of public record upon accepting their job or their position. And I don't understand how we as an employer could force that on city employees, especially when we know it could put them at risk of harassment and worse. It's one thing for city commissioners to have their information on the public record. I have been stalked, harassed, accosted, and assaulted since I was elected by members of the public, and I couldn't possibly support putting our city employees in a similar position. So can you explain, I mean, I just don't even understand how this could be legal.
I'm happy to explain, okay. Commissioner Udaly. So the city typically for records of personnel information for our employees, applies an exemption to the public records law for items such as personal cell phone numbers, personal email addresses, social security numbers, that kind of information. And we have successfully applied that exemption pretty consistently. However, the way that exemption is written, it's unclear whether that only applies if the information is located within an employee's personnel record. And the district attorney has taken the position that any of those pieces of information which are not located within a personnel record are not in fact exempt under this particular statute. And the public records law is a law of disclosure rather than a law of exemption. So the district attorney's position was that because he did not construe this particular exemption to apply to personal cell phone numbers located in our SMARSH data, that the numbers must in fact be disclosed. The city has consistently taken a position with the DA that interpretation of that statute is incorrect, that it is meant to apply to any sort of personal information to city employees, regardless of whether it's located in a personal record or not. And this happens to be the first case that we've had before us where the posture is such that we have it available to us to argue in front of the Multnomah County Circuit Court, which is the next appellate body for public records requests, to interpret that statute to determine if it does in fact protect public employee personal information that's located outside of personnel records. The other exemption that we have asserted and that the district attorney has not found to be applicable in this case, which we would argue again in this lawsuit, is the statute exempting disclosure of information if it's an invasion of personal privacy. Again, the district attorney did not interpret that exemption to apply in this case, and we would be asserting and arguing before the Multnomah County Circuit Court that it does in fact apply as well.
Okay. I mean, yeah, I understand that much. What I continue to struggle with in light of the DA's position is how we could force that circumstance on an employee without prior agreement from them. Or, you know, not every city employee has a city-issued phone or even a city-issued email. So if we're asking them or requiring them to use their personal cell phone or email in order to communicate with their workplace, and that puts that information at risk of being disclosed to the public, it seems to me that we would have to inform them of that, get their consent, and or issue city phones and emails to them so they can avoid it altogether. It just seems like a very sticky situation that potentially puts our employees in a very unfair position.
And the city attorney's office agrees, which is why we want to ensure that we are advancing the interests of our employees' personal privacy in this particular matter so that we can continue to assert that exemption that would cover their personal information, regardless of whether or not it's located in a personnel record.
Yeah.
The other, should the Multnomah County Circuit Court disagree with the city's position and agree with the DA's position, probably the next step would be a legislative fix to that, because it is our position at the city attorney's office that information should not be disclosed for exactly the reasons that you've stated, Commissioner Udaly. And we wouldn't think as city employees that information would be subject to disclosure. We don't think that was the intent of the legislature when they passed a specific exemption regarding personal pieces of information.
Yeah, and I know we're running over time and I don't want to take up more time, but I'll just say that we know that city employees face harassment and abuse from the public in their workplace or out in the field. And it's just absolutely unacceptable to me that we would share their personal information so that harassment and abuse could follow them home. I'm sure that whoever, you know, is advancing this lawsuit has good intentions and certainly doesn't want to imperil our employees, but you know, this isn't about keeping information from the public that they're entitled to having. It's about protecting and respecting our employees' privacy. So thank you.
Very good. Any further questions or comments on this? Keelan, I assume there is not public testimony on this item?
No, no testimony.
All right, very good. Please call the roll.
Mayor, really quick, just a point of order. I want to check in with our attorney. I believe we may need a motion or a second for the motion to suspend the rules.
Yes, that's Keelan.
Was that an affirmative we do?
Yes, we do.
Okay, can I get a second?
Second.
I've moved. We have a second for the suspension of the rules. Call the roll on the suspension.
Daly.
Aye.
Fritz.
Good catch, Keelan. Thank you. Aye.
Ryan.
Aye.
Hardesty.
Aye.
Wheeler.
Aye. We've retroactively suspended the rules to the beginning of this discussion. Now call the roll on the main motion, the 4/5 agenda item.
You, Daly.
Well, I strongly support access to public records. Portlanders deserve to know how their government operates, and transparency is insurance for accountability. Far too often I've heard or read about unnecessary delays, expense, or obstacles to legitimate public records requests, and I share the public's frustration and concern about that. That said, I support this resolution because city employees should not have to surrender their right to personal privacy as a condition of employment. In this era of doxing, harassment, and worse, we need to protect our employees' personal information. Aye.
Fritz.
Aye.
Ryan.
Aye.
Hardesty.
Aye.
Wheeler.
Aye. The ordinance is adopted and we are adjourned until 2 p.m. Thank you, everybody.